Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, November 21st, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 712-770-4160. And I suppose everybody on this call knows that that's the new number now. Participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, it's plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Excuse me. Okay. Tonight's scripture is 1 John chapter 4. We're going to read verses 7 through 21, the commandment of love. 1 John chapter 4, 7 through 21. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. In this was manifested the love of God towards us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world that we might live through him. Herein is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we ought also to love one another. No man hath seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. Hereby know we that we dwell in him, and he in us, because he hath given us of his Spirit. And we have seen and do testify that the Father sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Whosoever shall confess that Jesus is the Son of God, God dwelleth in him, and he in God. And we have known and believed the love that God hath to us. God is love. And he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, and God in him. Herein is our love made perfect, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fears, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. We love him because he first loved us. If any man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen? And this commandment have we from him, that he who loveth God love his brother also. Okay, that was 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 through 21. Okay, we don't particularly have a topic for tonight, with the exception, of course, we'll talk a little bit about the fact that we're preparing to go into the courts. Up on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, if you highlight grand jury, come down to grand jury and then click on docket, or just put in nationallibertyalliance.org/docket, and you can see we're preparing a case to go into the courts. We've been talking quite a bit about this over the past weeks. We've been reading some papers. So we don't have a paper this week to read. We have a couple papers very close to being ready for corrections as far as, we just have a little more left to do, but we didn't have to have it checked for punctuation and different corrections. But hopefully next week we'll have one. Probably the one we'll read next week, which would be probably the most important one, which will be our paper to the president-elect. And we've never written anything to the president. It's in the office right now because we know it's not going to go anywhere. So we've always addressed either Congress or we've addressed the courts. We've even addressed at one time the United States Supreme Court. On this case, this is a case for redress of grievances. We're not asking for it. We're telling them this is an unalienable right. We have the right to redress for grievances. We want to talk about our grievances, and we're going to fix them. And we want these people to start obeying the law. Now, we have, like I said, we have three papers going to be going out. Well, actually, four papers. We have two papers that are going to go to Congress. Probably going to do a little bit different on the Senate than we will on the Congress, on the other House. But we will be sending to both of them. And again, I'm not sure how much of a difference, if much at all. We're also going to, so that's to the legislature. We're going to be sending a paper, of course, to the United States Supreme Court. They're responsible for the actions of the federal courts. The federal courts have left their jurisdiction. We're not going to make it clear and known to the United States Supreme Court, and it's their duty and their job to correct that problem and command through a habeas corpus that they start hearing cases within its proper jurisdiction and under the common law. We also are going to send one to the President of the United States, the President-elect, who is not in office yet, but we have a lot to talk to him about. You know, he's said quite a bit over the past months as he's been running for president and things over the years. And now we're going to kind of hold his feet to the fire. It's going to be reasonably friendly on the one hand, but it's also going to be demanding on another side. And again, that's probably the paper we're going to read next week. We also are going to be sending these papers, a paper also to all governors, all 50 governors. So we're covering really, you know, all 50 governors and the three branches in the federal level. And I think we have a great opportunity. We do have a sort of a avenue open line of communications to some degree with the president's people. I don't know exactly who you would call them. I don't know, Robert, are you here, Robert? And maybe you can explain that connection a little better than I can. It came out of Oregon. We have sent some papers out to Oregon to go to the president-elect a few months back. At that point in time, he wasn't elected yet, but he was interested, I understand, in what we're doing. Robert, are you here?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, can you give us a little more information? Can you give us any information on what kind of a connection we might have?
Well, during the campaign, Mr. Trump knew about the land grab and these arrests and everything that's been going on by the feds, and he wanted to know the truth. And so he sent a message out to the campaign people here in Oregon wanting at that time to set up some people to talk with in meetings. However, this lady here in Oregon came and told me about it, and I got a hold of John, and we put together a packet of the papers that we've written, because those papers pretty well tell the story of what happened and what's going on with the feds. And so we delivered these papers to the campaign people here in Oregon. Mr. Trump sent some people out to the lady's house. They scanned all the papers and they encrypted them, and everything went to Mr. Trump and to the RNC also. And so pretty much all the Republican Party anyway knows what we're doing and the papers that we've written. And it's been talked about a little bit by Trump over time. But anyway, the last word I got from the campaign is that they've taken everything we gave them and turned it into a book of some sort. And he has shown great interest in freeing these people that were, you know, illegally arrested and taken to court. And he's also wanting to stop this land grab. And so now we're talking about, you know, now we want to update what we previously sent to him to let him know, you know, bring him up to date on where everything stands right now. And, of course, there's a couple other things that I asked John to add into it. I don't want to go into that right now because I think it's better if nobody has a chance to jump the gun and do something to prevent what we're asking. But anyway, we're bringing him up to date. He's still very interested. He knows about us. He knows who we are. And so we feel like we may be able to work with him.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Yeah, so this is a great, great opportunity for us, and we are putting together a complete package of work that we put together over the year or two, and a lot of stuff. And we're also including the papers that we will be filing in the courts. You know, when we file the papers in the courts, we're going to file papers directly to Congress, for instance. And the papers we sent to Congress is not going to be sent to the Supreme Court or to the governor's. But we will copy these papers to the president, okay? Same thing with the governors. The papers we sent to the governors will be directed to the governors. We're going to be operating or running many cases out from underneath this one number that we're going to get up in Albany. And again, hopefully in the next week or so. We are running a collection right now. I sent out an email last night concerning our need for money in order to do all this work. The papers, hopefully, you know, I mean, we've got a good part of this done. I think we could say that the papers going to Congress is very close to being done, and soon we'll be, you know, bringing them together to clean them up. Also, to the president is pretty much almost done, and to the Supreme Court is almost pretty much done. The ones to the governors we'll have to start, but again, that shouldn't take too long. But we are going to send a copy of everything we post into the case to the president. Now, we have about 30 or so habeas corpuses that have not been acted upon. We're going to bring these into the case. We're going to bring these people to bear in a court of justice to tell us why that they think that they can bypass the law and decide not to give people their due process, because that's what a habeas corpus is. You know, a habeas corpus is a statutory process, which really is a statutory way that we force the judges or the courts to give the people the due process. But due process is already written in the Fifth Amendment. We have a right of due process. It's an unalienable right. Every man has a right to face their accuser, and they have a right to demand that they swear on whatever charges are before them. These things are never done, or very rarely are done, shall I say, anyway. And this is what all these habeas corpuses are about. These are all cases where people, they have never had the opportunity to face their accuser. There are no sworn affidavits or papers. In many cases, in most of them, there's no grand jury and no trial jury. And some that are grand juries or trial juries, they're puppet juries. They have nothing to do with common law. They have nothing to do with justice. It's not due process. So we're going to bring those cases in. There's some other cases we're going to bring in. And, of course, all of the papers, I believe, I'm not sure exactly how many we filed over the year or so, but I think it's up around, goodness, I don't even remember. It's quite a few. But we're going to get together all those papers because they have been information. They tell the story. Now, we the people need to be educated. And anybody that really wants to get educated in what we're doing, anybody that wants to become an administrator, and those opportunities I think are coming up quite soon. I really do think we're going to get a positive feedback from the White House, or shall I say from Mr. Trump, maybe before he goes into office. We're going to get a positive feedback. I'm pretty sure of that. I believe he's going to support us. After all, we're talking about the law. If he wants to make America great again, he needs to fix the problem. And fix the problem is very simple. Force these people to obey the law. Let him spend his executive orders properly and give them orders to obey the law. Let him send out orders to the marshals to obey the law. And if they don't know the law, well, here's where you can go to find out about the law. Here's where you can learn about the law. But anyway, we're going to be needing 4 administrators. Most people know this, for every county in America. These are paid positions. We're going to take the place of these people that are in the courts now. Right now, the judges handle the trial juries, and the prosecutors usually handle the grand juries. But the court system itself sort of chooses these people. You know, as far as who's going to be on the jury, they give them questionnaires, they give them an orientation, and they take them totally away from the common law and bring them into statutory processes. And therein is the reason why we need to take it away from these people, and we the people, unconnected to political processes, not connected to any of these things, but just have a desire for justice. And we'll take oaths concerning that justice. We put together a nice plan on that. And all people have to do is read our front page and follow through with the links and watch the videos and so on, and they'll learn a lot more about this. Anybody that is wants to be an administrator in your county or your county next door, you don't have to work in the same county you live in. Anybody who wants to be an administrator, there are 4 for each county. They need to be taking our courses. Nobody is going to be able to become an administrator unless they've taken our 2 courses. One is the constitutional course, and it's free, and the other one is the civics course, and that's free. So both those courses need to be taken. For an advancement of that course would really be to study all the papers that we're going to be filing on that page that I gave you, which is nationallibertyalliance.org/docket. Now, if you go there's already some papers up there. We've got some evidence documents that we're going to be putting into the court that we've already put up there. We've got some law documents that we're going to be filing into the court. And we have some court filings that we've already written. We have an information on martial law, which has already went out to everyone, but we're going to resubmit that in this particular court case. We have the memorandum of facts and statement of jurisdiction. We will have a memorandum of law here, which should be up here shortly. I think that's already written, and we combined a couple of papers together, but it's already written. We'll just run through the check and get it perfected one more time, and then we'll get it up here. Then, again, as I mentioned, there'll be 4 papers going out, one to each branch of government and one to the governors. Now, one we send to one governor, all governors will get the same papers. Only their name will take the lead on it. So everything that's going on this page here in the docket page is an education, okay? And these papers explain and help to give us an insight on our founding documents, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and even the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence. So, again, this in itself is an education. You know, if a people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. So we have to become educated in order to take on the necessary duties that we the people should be taking on. But we can't do it ignorantly. We need to understand the common law. We need to understand the Constitution. We need to understand the powers and authorities that we the people gave to these servants that are, you know, in our 3 branches of government, and we need to know when they're overstepping their authority. Now, I have heard, and we spoke about this last week a little bit, that Chris Ann Hall was going to make a connection with the Trump administration and something to do with creating a new position called the Department of Constitutional Education, which is something definitely we would need. And, of course, we're trying to make contact with her, and we'd like to support what she's doing and maybe work with her on these things. But I know she's away, and I think she'll be back after the holidays. I think she left the country for 2 or 3 months. But anyway, we'll try to make that connection when she gets back, and hopefully she'll be able to make a good connection with the White House and get something like that going. But it's up to the people to make sure that these legislators don't make any laws that overstep the authority that we've given them, whatever lawmaking we have given them. And the lawmaking we have given them is clearly defined in the Constitution. And we never gave them any lawmaking abilities to make any law to control the behavior of we the people. So they can't make any laws there. Any laws that they've already made in that area is null and void. You know, all these gun laws and everything ultimately are null and void. Once we get this court case going and we start to bring that to bear, we're going to make that point clear. And then we, the people, need to get rid of these permits we think we have to have in order to carry a weapon. Of course, it does make sense that whoever sells these weapons, maybe certain individuals we might agree upon, shouldn't be able to get a weapon, and they should be listed in a computer. And that would be that simple. Look, it doesn't take a computer 3 months or 6 months or a year to see if you got a problem, because that's what they're doing is looking at a computer. But they'd wait years sometimes. I know in Dutchess County it took me 2 years before I got my permit. Some places people get it a month or two or three, but generally speaking, it's all over the place. Okay, so anyway, these papers need to be going out. We do need money to do this. Those who are not supporting National Liberty Alliance, really take a consideration of what we're doing and consider supporting us by giving us $5 a month or more. But beyond that, we're also asking everyone if they can send in an additional donation this week, this month, in order to help us cover the cost for filing all these papers. I'd like to file all these papers through FedEx. And that's, I think, like $20, $19.95 or something like that. I don't know. That's how I'd like to file it. But we need the money in order to do that, and that could get quite expensive. But at minimum, we'll probably do certified, I think. But even there, you know, that puts up the cost factors. I think that's all I have. But Gerard, do you have anything to add to this, or anybody else have anything to add to this? What we're talking about here?
No, I'm good for now, John. I got a couple of things I'm doing here. I'll pipe in later. Yeah.
Okay, Jen, do we have any questions out there?
No, sir. This week we do not have any questions.
No questions. Okay.
No questions.
All right. So what we'll do is we'll move right over to Brent Winters. Brent is here, I think. Is he not? By the way, I see all the names have been cleaned off. Since we come onto this new number, so we're going to have to re-add them. When people come up to the mic, we'd like you to give us your first name and your state, and then we'll add the names into these numbers. Let us make sure. Who will be adding? Will that be you, Jan? Is there anyone else out there helping you on this? You're probably muted if you're talking. Okay, maybe you stepped away from the mic. All right, anyway, let's, Brent, are you here?
I'm here.
How you doing, Brent?
I'm all right. Good talk to you. I mean, yeah, go ahead.
Let's move over to Brent Winters. Brent Winters has the book out, Excellence in Common Law. You also visit his website, commonlawyer.com. And Brent, you got the mic right ahead.
Well, two things. Again, thanks for letting me come on. I enjoy it very much. You had mentioned a while ago questions. Did anybody provide any questions? Well, one fella provided me with some questions, and they're good questions, in my opinion, questions that should be talked about. I'll just briefly try to hit them, and then I'll move on to what you had suggested last time, John, talking about reviewing the four militia clauses briefly and then discussing the Dick Act and what it has done, whether good or bad. But let me start with the questions. The question, two of them, from a fella, said this: from whom did Thomas Jefferson lift the phrase, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, found in our Declaration of 76. And he asked this, was it Blackstone or John Locke or both? Well, the simple, quick answer is, it was all three, Blackstone, John Locke, and both, plus more. And the people who have produced this phrase, have coined it, as we say, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, which Tom Jefferson did lift from John Locke and put into our Declaration of 76, lifted it from his ideas, lifted it also. It was in Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, popularly called Commentaries on the Common Law, but that's not really the title. It was Commentaries on the Laws of England, and of course that did amount to the Common Law. But it's found in the first volume there. Blackstone uses it and defines the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God as that phrase referring to the two volumes of God's revelation of his will to man. Two volumes. The first, unwritten, in the nature of things, that means unwritten in creation. Observable, sometimes we write down our observations. And when we do, we call that our common law. And that takes in a lot more than is normally discussed. It takes in more than just court cases. It takes in maxims. It takes in even legislation. It's the duty of our legislators to observe what is right and to legislate according to the common law. As a matter of fact, our common law has always said anything, any legislation contrary to the first principles of our common law is suspect. Suspect. And it requires heavy scrutiny. That's what our common law has always said. So that phrase, the laws of nature and the laws of nature of God, the first part of it, the laws of nature, Blackstone tells us in his day, that was about 10, 11 years before our Declaration of 76, his commentaries were published from lectures he delivered in the year 1765 at Oxford, and then they were published. That first one is unwritten in nature, in creation. Takes in all of the laws of Newtonian physics, all of the laws of that we haven't even observed yet, maybe, things we haven't even discovered yet. It takes in all of nuclear physics and the laws we've discovered that govern the nature of creation. Then second, the second volume, are the laws of nature's God. And Blackstone tells us that in his day that phrase signified the second volume of God's revelation of his will to man, called the Bible. Blackstone also calls it revealed religion. I don't know exactly where that came from, but I have a good idea. But he calls that second volume, the Bible, revealed religion. By the way, in Blackstone's commentaries, the Bible, as he refers to it, consists of 66 books, 39 books in the Old Testament, 27 books in the Newer Testament. By the way, you can always remember how many books are in the Newer Testament. All you have to do is remember how many are in the Old Testament, 39. And this is not mathematically accurate, but just a good way to remember. 39, three nines are 27. 39 books in the Old Testament, three nines are 27, and there happen to be 27 in the Newer Testament. Those are the books that it is a collection of inspired writings, not a inspired collection of writings. That's different. It's a collection of inspired writings. It is not the collection that's inspired. It is the books themselves. Reformers made much of that, and they did a good job of it. I won't go back and explain what they mean when they say that, but just keep in mind, the books are breathed of God. That was Blackstone's point of view, and he excluded from those 66 books the what's called the apocryphal writings included in the Roman Catholic version of the Bible. Included, by the way, also in the King James Version when it was originally published, the apocryphal books. Those books have historic significance. They tell us a lot about history, but they're not part of the laws of nature's God written in the Bible. Well, and you can read more about that, Blackstone's first commentaries. That's where he starts. He starts with fundamental law, and that's the fundamental law he starts with. And he says anything that is contrary to this is not law at all. Not law at all. So the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God did not, however, originate with Blackstone. And he who never quotes, one of my favorite quotes, is he who never quotes is never quoted. And Blackstone, of course, he didn't make that up. That was a popular phrase in his day. And he received that phrase. It arose, we find it among, and we don't know exactly who did it, but we find it among those that were part of what we call today the Scottish Enlightenment. The Scottish Enlightenment. The Scottish Enlightenment produced things like Encyclopedia Britannica. The Scottish Enlightenment, the men that were behind it, it was something, again, that arose out of the Reformation and then continued. It arose out of the Reformation with John Knox. He was one of the key figures, and he recognized the supreme authority of the laws of nature's God written in the Bible. And out of that, then, with the Scottish Enlightenment, was added the laws of nature. And many of the disciplines of modern science have arisen out of that, and we are just now experiencing the end of the Scottish Enlightenment, which arose in the 1500s, reached its apex probably in the early 1800s. By the way, the first publication of the Encyclopedia Britannica was in the year 1776, the day we declared our separation from Britain. And our declaration of separation from Britain was a result of, to great measure, the Scottish Enlightenment, which was a British, it became a British movement. Much to be said. Matter of fact, the whole idea of the high school came out of the Scottish Enlightenment. And the first high schools were in Scotland, and of course we have them in the United States. The Carnegie Libraries were a part, were the tail end winding down of the Scottish Enlightenment, thousands of them all over the world. And what Carnegie's ideas came, he was a great fan of the Scottish Enlightenment. So that phrase, it's a beautiful phrase, the laws of nature, the laws of nature's God, came from the Scottish Enlightenment, which began with John Knox, and men that went before him that were also, and many of them were killed. John Knox, when I say killed, I mean burned at the stake. John Knox was captured by a French galley, French warship, at the behest of the Pope of Rome, and an iron collar was put around his neck for 4.5 years, and he rode warships, and he's lucky he lived through it. And then the Reformation in Scotland occurred after that. It's hard to beat a man that has suffered that much and not been beaten. It is the suffering that makes men invincible. At any rate, that's that. And the other side, the other question that this fella had, good question, he said, is the militia subject to martial law? Is the militia, that is the militia of the several states of our Constitution, the four militia clauses, is it subject to martial law? And the answer is yes, when called out, that means subpoenaed, called out, and once the militiaman is mustered for duty, whether at the calling out of the governor of his state or at the calling out of the president of the United States, he is subject to the martial law. Yes, he is. And all military forces, all, the word martial means military. That's why we call it martial law. It's the old militia, by the way, is related to the word martial. Those are both Latin words that have crept into our language from the old Roman world and the university system of Rome that eventually covered Europe and Britain with Oxford and Cambridge. But all of that has given us the word militia. It used to be called in Anglo-Saxon, which is Old English, it was called the Fyrd, F-Y-R-D, the Fyrd, and with the advent and the imprint of Rome, the word militia has stuck. And the martial law is the law of military units. The martial law has many labels still, and even in our common law country, there are four labels under which martial law legitimately exists, but always very dangerous. To get even further back, the martial law, as we understand it today, is the law of the Roman legions. The law of the Roman legions, and Rome made the law of the Roman legions, that martial law, the law of the empire, and they called it imperial law. It has no jury. It has no due process. And when the emperors became very powerful, they got that martial law down to a science. The Roman legions worked very well under martial law, their brand of it, and it was it was useful to them, and it's useful to our military units today also. But the martial law, admiralty law, is a form of martial law with a different label. Administrative law, which reached its apex during the days of Napoleon in France, it's a French idea, and it's applied to government. It does exist. It should be limited very tightly. It is not. It has come to control our entire country, administrative law. It's probably. Martial law is the great danger under the label, the greatest danger to America under the label, administrative law. During the Declaration of 76, when we separated from Britain, martial law was the greatest danger under the label admiralty law. It's still a great danger, admiralty law in America. And we can see that through the Army Corps of Engineers and their attempts to control all the land of the United States, and not only the navigable waters, and extending the admiralty jurisdiction to, we now have control, says the feds, over rainwater, and you can't have a rain barrel anymore. You can't build a pond anymore. We're talking about the fella up in the Northwest is now suffering in jail because he built a pond to water his stock, his horses. That's the martial law. And no, we are not under martial law. Common law is the antithesis, the martial law, the opposite, the great antagonist through history. But the martial law does have a valid use, and that is with military units. You see, the martial law is effective where somebody wants immediate obedience to orders. That's why we call it the law of the city. That's another law for another label for the martial law, the law of the city, the civil law. Civil is the Latin word for city, and it's useful. And that's why people who govern cities, and they don't want to put up with people, and they don't have time for due process, or they think that administratively, there's the word administrative law. Administrative law doesn't have a jury either, if you'll notice. It's the law of command of the governor or of the mayor, of the executive, of the president. It's just the law of command. It is imperial. That means it is not yours to wonder why, it is yours but to do or die. Well, that's all right if you're fighting a war and the survival of the country is at stake, and obedience to orders, immediate obedience, is of utmost importance, and obedience to orders is not immediate in some situations. Death is the penalty. I remember taking a test once where I had to learn about martial law. And the reason I had to learn about it, because I was under it. And so we had a test, and we had to learn. I was with old Perkins. I remember Perkins was from Bowdoin, Georgia. Route 1, Bowdoin, Georgia. And we sat down on the floor, and we were trying to learn the answers to the questions. And we finally figured out, and we both passed because we finally figured out, that no matter what the question was, if you just wrote down that the penalty for whatever they were talking about was always death, or as a court-martial may direct, you had the right answer. Death. The penalty is death, or as the court-martial may direct. That's the penalty. And I'd mentioned before, and I'd like to understand the power of martial law, and read a good book at the same time. Herman Melville's book, discovered many decades, or a couple decades after his death, in his papers, never published. It's now published. It's a little tiny short story called Billy Budd. Billy Budd, Sailor. That's the title, Billy Budd, Sailor. Budd spelled B-U-D-D. And it's all about martial law and how much he hated it. He had been a sailor himself. But Billy Budd was executed, hung from the yardarm, without intent to do anything wrong. But he did cross a line that the law said that he was not supposed to cross. And under imperial law, it's a strict liability kind of thing. It doesn't make any difference what your intent is, and it doesn't make any difference whether there's an injured party. I hear much talk, and have for decades, from patriots that there can't be a crime unless there's an injured party. That's true, common law. But at martial law, that's not always true. And that's the difference, again, between the law of Rome, the law of the city, martial law, administrative law. It's a strict liability kind of policy that governs it. If you inadvertently cross a line, and that's what happened in Billy Budd, it's a fascinating story. It's worth reading. Doesn't take long. Short book. You can probably order it off the internet someplace. But at any rate, no, we're not under martial law as Americans, but if we are summoned and mustered at the point of muster, then you come under martial law. Well, let's get to what John had suggested last time. I want to talk about, review quickly, the four militia clauses and talk about the detriment, what I consider to be detriment of the Dick Act of 1903, the Militia Act of 1903, and what it's done to us, how it's skewed us from our Constitution, and how people have, unfortunately, accepted its tenets. And I'll show you how in a case study of how that's happened. Our Constitution's plan, our Constitution of the United States, I might add, is simple. It has four militia clauses, and each of these clauses bestow a different set of duties upon different jurisdictions of persons. Four jurisdictions of persons, four militia clauses, and each clause of our Constitution puts a different duty on each different set of persons. The first set of persons, the duty, the militia clauses put the duty on, is Congress. The second set of persons is the government of the states. The third set of persons is the President of the United States, or Presidents of the United States. And the fourth set of persons is a little different. It doesn't put a duty on anybody. It's the only one of the four militia clauses that does not put a duty on anyone, delegates nothing, but simply recognizes and guarantees protection of a duty dropped on men from God. And that's the Second Amendment. It recognizes a duty, and it protects that duty because that duty is a fundamental duty dropped upon men direct from God himself. And when duties are dropped direct from the Creator, as our Declaration of 76 puts it, upon the individual, we call those not rights, but fundamental rights, foundational rights. And we have said and always said and need to continue to say out loud and often that those rights, those jurisdictions, are beyond the reach of any government. Why? Because God demands them of men. And it is beyond government to block a man's duty before God direct without any intermediary. No government in between him and God. No professor, no Supreme Court, no Pope, no priesthood, no preacher, no nothing. When a man's of age, and of age, in my stated opinion, is 20 years old, they've got good law on it. At any rate, four militia clauses. The first militia clause delegates a duty from the people, that is the militia themselves, to Congress. Says this, Congress shall have power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. Second, to suppress insurrections. Third, to repel invasions. Execute the laws of the Union. That's federal law, friends. Suppress insurrections and repel invasions. Those are the only three situations that the militia of the several states or any part of them may be called out. Second, Congress has the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Now, when you examine these closely, look, it says Congress has the power to provide for the calling forth of the militia for those three reasons. That means write down rules. Write down rules for the president to use. We'll get to that. That's all that means. It says also they have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining. To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. And for governing. The governing, that means you set up a martial law for them. For all the militia of the several states. That's what that means. And, of course, we have that today. It's called the Uniform Code of Military Justice. All military forces of the United States are under that Uniform Code of Military Justice. And when the militia of the several states or any part of them are duly summoned and mustered upon mustering, then that person comes under this martial law in the form of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. When our country started, we had no martial law, no code for our military. The Continental Congress had nothing. Had to take a sip there just a minute. The Continental Congress had nothing. And so what Congress did, they took the martial law code of the British Army and they enacted that code word for word for the Continental Army of the United States. Of course, as some people point out, if you want to miss this, they deleted all references to King George. But other than that, it was exactly the same code. It was a good code. And that's what George Washington wanted. Not only that, George Washington, of course, had served as an officer of the British Army. And he was familiar, very familiar with that code, and that's why he wanted it. He liked it. He was used to it. And it wasn't a bad one. Of course, then we did, Congress did commission some Prussians and some French officers to come help us train. The Prussians were very good at it. The Germanic people have always been good at being precise. That was the trouble with them. They were too quick to take on the Roman code after they got rid of the common law during the days of Luther. And there's a whole story behind that. Well, the first militia clause has to do with power delegated to Congress. The second militia clause has to do with power delegated to the states. It says this. This is our Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16. It says, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. You see, Congress prescribes the discipline and the martial law, the code, and they give it to the states. But Congress has no power of enforcement over that. The states are to use it, and the governors of each state are to use that for the militia of the respective of his state, of each of the respective states. That's the law of the land. Every state militia, therefore, would be under the same martial law. That's the design of our Constitution. But Congress is not given the power of enforcement. Congress is given the power of writing the law and given it to the governors to put into practice. And notice also, Congress nor the president, either one of them, have power to appoint the officers of the state militias, each of them. That's too much power. And our Constitution says that belongs to the states, and the states can do it any way they want. Now, most states would probably say the governor, being commander-in-chief of the militia, of that state's militia, the state governor would have the power also to appoint officers or decide how it would be done. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So the first militia clause delegates powers to Congress to write up laws for the militias of the several states and to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and governing them. Now, when it says to provide for the organizing, arming, that is for when they are called in to federal duty, national duty. Second militia clause has to do with the states. The third militia clause has to do with that class of persons called presidents of the United States. It says this, the president shall be commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states. Here's the proviso, though. Watch this. When called into the actual service of the United States, the president of the United States has no power, no authority, no right over the militia of the several states or any part of them or any person in them unless and until called into actual service. Now, commenters of our long time past, 175 years ago and before, tell us that what this means is this. There are two things that must happen before the president has jurisdiction over any member of the militia of the several states. First, he has to call them. Today we might say summons. He has to get his orders in the mail. Oh my goodness, I've been called by the president of the United States to be at such and such such a place and to bring such and such a weapon. That's being called, and that's called sometimes in our court system, we call that a subpoena. by the way, in the Bible has the Roman word for that. The word is familiar, no doubt, to some of you. It's a well-known Greek word in the New Testament, ekklesia. Ekklesia is a subpoena. Ek means out, and klesia, klesia means to call out. Same word here, call, when called into actual service. But actual service, says the commenters of decades gone by, means that you're mustered. I said that a while ago. That's why I said that, because you, two things have to happen. You have to have been duly subpoenaed. Subpoenaed. That's a subpoena, by the way, is always very personal. It's not a group thing. You get it personally in the mail. I remember people used to get draft notices. Unconstitutional thing to draft people, but that was the law there until 1973, I believe, 1973. And a draft notice, though, is personal. It's not, the call doesn't go out, I need 20,000 people in a general way, a general call. No, it's not general. It's specific. It's specific. It comes to you personally, has your name on it. So when the president has summoned or subpoenaed a fella, and he's answered the subpoena, and somebody says, so-and-so, are you present? When the officer says that, and he says present, at the moment he says present, he's under martial law, whatever martial law Congress has prescribed. By the way, the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, is the third militia clause, and that governs, delegates the duties respecting the militia of the several states given to the presidents of the United States. And then there is the fourth militia clause, better known as the Second Amendment. That militia clause, the only one, it delegates no duties. It simply recognizes a duty, a fundamental right, which is a duty of self-preservation, a duty to protect yourself, your family, and your neighbors, and your state from harm. It says this, a well-regulated militia, that means regular, that means ready, by the way, ready, constantly ready. How do you stay constantly ready? Well, you keep and carry. That's what it says here. A well-regulated, that means a ready militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right, is an old word that means duty, an old Anglo word, an old Germanic word that means duty. The duty of the people, that is the militia, that's what the people means. The duty of the people to keep and bear, that means to keep and carry. To keep and carry arms shall not be infringed. Well, that's the four militia clauses, and that's what they kind of mean. And then we'll want to talk about the Dick Act. The Dick Act, known also as the Militia Act of 1903. There was a Militia Act of 1792. Congress tried to put in statutory form an enforcement, a little more detail, to enforce the four militia clauses of our Constitution of the United States. And they did that. And after the Spanish-American War, one of the veterans of that war, a fella, a congressman, by the name of Charles Dick, he said this didn't work too well. The militia units didn't work musterable. Things weren't efficient, et cetera, et cetera. And so he came up with these ideas to pass a new militia act, and Congress did so in 1903. And what the Militia Act of 1903 did was put a lot more power in the hands of the federal government. Power to buy equipment, power to buy arms. And notice I do not say authority. I say power. Because anything that's contrary to our Constitution is not authority. It's not right. It's not law. It just carries the banner of law. It's a false flag. And I believe the Dick Act, and much of it, in its fundamentals, is unconstitutional. And the Dick Act said this, and this is something that isn't constitutionally known. He said there's an organized and unorganized militia. And the organized militia came to be known as the National Guard. And with the National Guard then came also an oath not to support and defend the Constitution of any particular state, but to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But it was a change to stress that. I mean, even George Washington said we had to do that because people were loyal to their states, and often what state militia, what would happen with state militias, this happened during the War of 1812. The militia, I think it was of Vermont. Yeah, Vermont. The governor of Vermont, the militia was called to leave the state of Vermont and to fight the British by the president of the United States. And the governor said, you can't do that. You can't take a militia of my state out of my state. Our common law requires, and our Constitution, being a brief common law government, our common law requires that the militia of my state has to stay in my state and do what it does in my state and the militia of other states. Well, the governor of Vermont lost that battle, and I believe rightly so, because the Constitution doesn't say, but the Constitution does say that the president has the power to call out the militia or any part of it, of any state, to do three things: repel invasions, put down insurrections, and enforce the laws of the United States. And President George Washington did that during the what we call the Whiskey Rebellion. And that was an important thing he did to establish the power of the president when he called the militia out. But the Dick Act put a tremendous amount of power in the federal government to train and equip militiamen. And once it did that, then the federal government, as they always do when they pay for things, under the old idea that he who pays the fiddler calls the tune. Well, the feds, they pay for the roads, they pay for the bridges, they pay for everything anymore. They take a lot more money in than the state governments, and then they want to shuffle it around, send it back, and charge us a broker's fee for doing so, and then say at the same time, if you don't do what we say, you don't get the money. And that's what they were doing with the Militia Act. If you don't do what we say, we're not going to pay for training your National Guard unit. Well, I guess it's the nature of politicians to give in to that kind of thing. I wish they wouldn't. I wish they'd say, so what? We don't care. We'll take care of ourselves. But that's what happened with the Dick Act. It was an act that put a tremendous amount of power in the federal government and established something that was constitutionally unknown, called the National Guard. The National Guard. The Dick Act, it set aside money, millions of dollars, a couple million bucks, which would amount to millions upon millions today, to modernize their equipment and to use federal funds for training National Guard units, what they called, the Dick Act called, the organized militia as opposed to the unorganized militia. And so that's how the federal government has creeped in to control National Guard units. All of these things that I'm talking about, the militia being divided into the organized and unorganized and the National Guard units, our Constitution gives no authority, no jurisdiction to the federal government to do any of those things, to pay for any of those things. Remember, our federal governments are governments of limited jurisdiction, limited powers. And those powers are found in Article 3, primarily. And anything beyond that that's not listed in that list, they don't have the power to do. It is not true what Justice Holmes said. Justice Holmes said this. He said, if the Constitution doesn't say that Congress can't do it, and then he cursed. I forget the curse words. I know a lot of curse words. I don't want to repeat them. He said, then they can do it. They can do whatever they want when the Constitution is silent. Where did he get that idea? I'll tell you where he got it. He got it from his false religion called existentialism, which had taken over New England and was responsible largely for the war between the states. Well, he was a part of that movement. He thought he was smarter than other people, so much so he advocated castrating and sterilizing young people who he said were imbeciles. Well, that's the kind of arrogant attitude we have trying to run things today. Well, that the Dick Act was a part of all that. Federal power, et cetera, et cetera. etc. It was a backlash and a continuation of the attitude that occurred in the attempts of union officers and union-minded people to crush the power of the states. And because of it, we're suffering today with the power that comes from a distant place that doesn't understand us, doesn't care about us, and wants to abuse us. That's the Dick Act. Well, let me just mention briefly, and I'll be done, how the Dick Act has worked out. And I'm going to cite as a one example, just one. This has happened a lot. The Constitution of the state of Illinois ratified in the year 1970. The Illinois Constitution of 1970 included a militia section, Article 12. And this is the law of the state of Illinois today. It says this, Section 1, the state militia of the state of Illinois consists of all able-bodied persons residing in the state, except those exempted by law. There are some people who are going to be exempted, of course. But it says, as a general rule, it consists of all able-bodied persons. That's changed from their constitution of exactly 100 years before. It said this, the state militia consists of all able-bodied males. But now the law of Illinois, or they say it's the law, the state militia consists of all able-bodied persons. Now, I don't believe that that's lawful. I don't believe it's lawful that the militia consists of the female. And the reason I don't say that is, I'd say it's a nation of cowards or a state of cowards that would require their most valuable citizens to face ugly bullets and shrapnel. But that's what it says. It came out of the idea of the Dick Act of 67 years before. Secondly, it says the military, that is the militia, shall be in strict subordination to the civil power. Well, I understand that was taken from our U.S. Constitution, taken from the common law. It says here the General Assembly, that's the legislature of Illinois, shall provide by law for the organization, equipment, and discipline of the militia in conformity with the laws governing the armed forces of the United States. Now, that largely is consistent with our Constitution, because what they're saying here is the discipline of our state militia must be in conformity with what Congress says it has to be. Well, that's what the militia clause in our Constitution says, so there's nothing wrong with that. Commander-in-Chief, Section 4. The governor of the state of Illinois is commander-in-chief of the organized militia. Notice it says organized militia. That came out of the Dick Act of 1903, except when they are in the service of the United States. Well, you see, if the president of the United States musters the militia before the governor beats him to the punch, then the president of the United States has control of that militia. And that's what happened when President Eisenhower was president during the days of civil unrest between the black men and women of the state of Arkansas and the white men and women of the state of Arkansas. And President Eisenhower was trying to enforce the going to school of a little black girl named Brown. Brown versus Board of Education. And I think the governor of Arkansas's name was Fobb. Maybe that was his first name. Anyway, he was a famous guy because of what happened. But Eisenhower called out the National Guard of Arkansas before the governor could do it. And by doing so, he ended up controlling the situation. Well, as a general principle, that's constitutional. What's unconstitutional about it is the National Guard is not constitutionally known. And no place does our Constitution give the Congress of the United States the powers that the Dick Act gave it, that our states have now taken on laws saying this is all constitutional and good and we agree. And then it says the governor shall commission militia officers of the state of Illinois who shall hold their commission for such time as may be provided by law. There's nothing wrong with that. But this particular Constitution of 1970 of the state of Illinois replacing the Constitution of the state of Illinois of 1870 has altered it just a little bit, just enough to conform to the fundamental principles of the Dick Act. And again, to put it in a nutshell, to sum up, the Dick Act of 1903 claimed to give power to the federal government to fund state militias in the form of what they called the National Guard, and by so doing, handed over control of the state militias. They claim it because they're paying for it. Handed over control of the state militias to the federal government. That's what I see is wrong with the Dick Act. It has perverted the balance of power that our Constitution gives us concerning the militia of the several states. Again, I will mention, then I'll quit. If you're interested more in my expanded ideas of what the militia is supposed to be, according to what I've come up with studying over the years under our Constitution and the Four Militia Clause, you can get the book. I've got a little book. It's about 100 pages, right at 100 pages. Not a very big book. Called The Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. The Militia of the Several States. If you can go to Amazon, I think you can get it there. Just type in Brent Allen Winters, and all my books will come up, about a half a dozen. One of them concerned the militia of the several states, and in the back of that is what I consider to be a good starting point for state militia legislation. The states as a group of people, the presidents as a group of people, and the Congress of the United States as a group of people have all ignored for 175 years the four militia clauses of our Constitution. The only group of people that have not ignored it in America are the people of the United States themselves. For they have remained armed. The people of the United States have remained armed. They have done their duty. They've even cried out and said, we're going to carry our weapons. We're going to carry them. We're going to be regular, well-regulated. We're going to be ready in season and out. And if we remain ready on an individual level, in season and out, we will put fear into our enemies, foreign and domestic, and it will keep peace like it has not been kept before if we will then add to it the full realization of our militia clauses. I'm done, John. If you want to go to the next step, that's enough for tonight. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Brent. All right, let's open up for Q&A. If anybody has any questions for Brent, star 6. Star 6 to get into the queue. Anybody has any questions for Brent?
A star 6 and then a 1.
And then a 1. When we get the people up here, maybe we can start putting their names in here. But we got to be careful not to put any names into the VoIP dialers. As a matter of fact, when people come in, if they're a VoIP dialer caller, we should remind them that when they come in on the VoIP, they should put their names in, their first name, and maybe their state. So,
right.
Okay, we got someone calling in from 718. Maybe you can give us your first name and your state. I think you're from New York, 718.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jeff. I'm from New York, Queens County.
Okay.
I just had a quick question. What was the name of that militia book that he mentioned?
The name of that book is The Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. That's the subtitle, but the author is Brent Allen Winters, A-L-L-A-N. And I think you can get it at Amazon.com. You can also get it, I know, at CommonLawyer.com.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's the question I have.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Next person, 617, give us your first name and your state, please.
Oh, Cynthia from Massachusetts. Hi, everyone. I just have a question. I'm reading this article about administrative court systems. It's in the website called ArmstrongEconomics.com. But this, several articles on the web, I guess recently or a couple of years ago, there was a ruling by a U.S. District Judge, Leigh Martin May, out of Atlanta, and is a 45-page ruling when he issued an injunction halting administrative law proceedings against a man by the name of Charles Hill, who's a businessman. But basically, out of this ruling, he said that administrative law is unlawful, and that the SEC, Security Exchange Commission agency, violated the appointment clause of the Constitution by subjecting this man Hill to proceedings before an administrative law judge. And so it goes on and on, but basically he ruled administrative law is unlawful. And I know we talk about that a lot, of what us as, you know, what we're being subjected to in these crazy courts. And I know, like, I've been inundated with all kind of crazy legal things, and it's just, there's no constitution in it. So, and I know we've talked about Chancery Court, and this article addresses it, and I'm just wondering if I'm misreading or if I'm missing something, because it sounds very clearly that this U.S. District Judge out of Atlanta ruled administrative law as unlawful. So I'm wondering if you've heard about that or what.
Brent, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, I will. Thanks. Administrative law, and now, by the way, Martin Armstrong, most of his stuff's pretty interesting. I don't know the man real well. I did sit down and eat a meal with him once. He's a nice guy, very quiet. He's studious. But the administrative law has been ruled unconstitutional, or was ruled unconstitutional in our country consistently as a French interloper until the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Roosevelt wanted to pass legislation, and he wanted power, and the people that controlled him, I should say, wanted power. They had the strings on him, and he would do anything that the bankers told him, and they wanted him to have the power to do what they wanted without having to ask Congress or any or the courts. And so that's what administrative law is, by the way. Administrative law is the executive doing whatever he wants. Executive orders. Obama did this. He just said, I don't care what the Constitution says. I don't care about the due process that says Congress or the Senate has to ratify treaties. I'm just going to do it anyway. Well, that's administrative law without even any administrative law from Congress. Well, the IRS operates solely almost by administrative law. The tax courts are administrative law courts. Clearly, they are not part of the judicial branch, regardless. The Supreme Court of the United States says we can't tell what branch they're from. Well, if you can't tell, let's just not be disingenuous and say they are the president's courts. He tells them what to do, and they do it. It's that simple. That's what administrative law is. During the days of Franklin Roosevelt, he wanted the federal government to have more power over the states. He wanted the power to do whatever he wanted, whatever he was told to do. And so he pushed, but his problem was the Supreme Court was blocking his legislation, saying this is unconstitutional what you're trying to do. They did it over and over. Well, he said, okay, you're going to do that. I'll just pack the court with as many Supreme Court justices as I want until I get the majority I want on the court.
Right.
Well, there's nothing in our Constitution that says there has to be 9 Supreme Court justices. As a matter of fact, we're operating now with 8. You see, there were 3 to begin with, and those are all common law questions. So he threatened to do that, and Justice Jackson, there were 9 justices on the court. He said, I'm going to put it up to 14 so he could get his way. Justice Jackson had been ruling against him, and Justice Jackson switched and started ruling for him. And history has called that the switch in time that saved 9. And ever since then, the states and the feds, the federal government, has gone like gangbusters, unstopped, coming on like horseradish. With administrative law, we are the most regulated, statutory world country. We have more statutes in our common law country than any civil law nation in the world. More statutes and regulations, and the regulations are now given the status of congressional statutes. And there is a presumption, let me get to this one quick. there's a presumption in our courts now that is pervasive, and the presumption is this: any administrative regulation enjoys the presumption of constitutionality unless proven by clear and convincing evidence otherwise. And I'm telling you, I've tried it. You can't get a court to go along with it. The Congress is king, and they say regulations are law, then regulations will be enforced as law, just like statutes. And that's what's happened to us. It is egregious. It is not law, in my humble studied opinion. Administrative law has no place in our country. I don't care how complicated things get for us. We do well just to scuttle it all. Well, I hope that gives you an idea of what I think about it.
Right, but I think this was a recent decision. I'm trying to track down the exact date, but it was within a couple of years, and I'm wondering if we can cite this, because I'm convinced a lot of these crazy courts are operating out of this, out of that kind of jurisdiction somehow when we get entrapped into it, you know?
Well, Justice Scalia put it this way before he emailed, but he said our judges, our world and our courts, our government, and even our courts are becoming nothing more than administrative-minded, and it's destroying our freedoms.
Right.
I don't know whether he was right deep down on the inside or whether he had nefarious motives. All the things that happened, he was murdered. I'm convinced of that at this point. Why? I don't know. But he said some right things. I'll say that about him. And he did say that we have become administrative-minded. We don't even know that there's a separation of co-equal powers. I talk to people a lot, intelligent people. They don't have a clue what our Constitution teaches about fundamental things, and that's all we really need to know, coming back to those fundamental things. This case you're talking about, if it is, and I think I heard about it, I saw it on the Internet, but it's just one little old case from one little old judge. It doesn't rule the country, and nobody's going to pay much attention to it. It's my prediction. But that doesn't mean that we need a critical mass of folk like you, who say, no, I don't believe that. I know it's wrong. That's what we need.
I'm trying to understand all the legalities and reading this, but I'm going to start look at this. There's a U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit.
Okay.
We got in the same case, so I'll read it. I have to read it through.
Well, again, you got to remember.
I don't want to even cite it, go into this court to cite this thing and just walk out. You know what I mean?
You got to remember, though, that you're in an administrative court. You're not going to be able to argue in an administrative court, and you're not going to get anywhere. And just because some federal district or a court or an appeals court makes a decision, that doesn't make it law either anyway, one way or the other. Look, the only way to argue these points or to even come close to trying to win is to take the jurisdiction process. They have hijacked you into jurisdictions unknown. That's what I say all the time. I don't belong to you. I don't even know where I'm at. So you hijacked me into jurisdictions unknown, and either you bring us back to the jurisdiction or we make a federal case of it, and you get them for violating your unalienable right of due process in a court of law. That's what it's all about. It's always about due process and jurisdiction. The only argument you ever need to make, because once you get into a real court where it is real jurisdiction and real due process, you're going to get the Constitution, and you're going to get what is common law, what is right and right. And that's the bottom line. But anyplace else, you're not going to get it. You're only giving them more power and authority by trying to argue it in their courts. You'll never get standing in their court. You don't want it anyway.
Right. Okay. All right. That helps. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the quiz.
Thanks.
Okay. Bye. Let's take our next caller here. Thanks, Cynthia. Fred from California. Go ahead, Fred.
Hello, this is California Fred with a question for Mr. Winters. Mr. Winters, the militia, what jurisdiction does it operate under, and how does it play in with the Geneva Convention with not using gas as a weapon or like any kind of weapon you could want? Or how do the police use hollow points when it's a violation of international law on a battlefield?
Well, keep in mind, to start that when it comes to war, the only possible enforcement is the fellow with the most power, and we can cite history for that. It's nice when people do abide by the Geneva Convention, but most of us probably have family members or maybe personally have experienced that in the real world, when we are encounter other nations abroad and our military forces, that the Geneva Convention is violated consistently, number one. But then number two, the militia of the several states, as a matter of law, when it is mustered into duty by the President of the United States, the militia or any part of them, the part mustered, becomes a part of the armed forces of the United States under the Commander-in-Chief called the President, and as such, such persons are subject to the law if it's duly authorized, for example, the Geneva Convention. Any militiaman subpoenaed and mustered comes under the law of the United States, whatever that martial law is, including treaties. Treaties also have the status of law. Our Constitution says so, if they are duly, by due process, the process due and owing to all that our Constitution gives us. Remember, our common law is the law of process above all things, not what should be done, but how it should be done. And that's how we differ from the law of the city. That's what the law of the land means, how things are to be done. And because in our common law, we're not limited to what we can do. We're just really what we're limited to is how we can do it. How we can do it. Not what we are to do. We don't need permission to act, but we need to act a certain way when we choose to do something. That's the difference between us fundamentally. By the way, that's the difference between God's law fundamentally and all other law. All other law is the law of false lawgivers, false gods. And that's what that's about. But our militiamen, all of us folk, I'm not in that category anymore as I understand it, but between the ages of 18, 20, 20 and 45, I like to say, able-bodied to carry a weapon. Not under the Geneva Convention, if the governor calls them out, unless that governor calls the militia out to repel an invasion and he doesn't have time to do anything but muster the troops. Arizona would have been within their rights if they'd have done that. When the forces from Mexico recently were shooting at people, and some said even invading. And, of course, that's what happened back in just before World War I, 1914. My grandmother used to tell me about Company A in our little town. And Company A, and she was sweet on a fella from Company A, and Company A got called, no, Company B, pardon me, Company B got called out to go chase Pancho Villa, and they were loading up at the little train station there, getting all their stuff together, and the fellow that was sweet on my grandmother got the mange. He loved dogs, and he got the mange, and they had to lock him in a second-story apartment above the crossroads there in town, and he could only holler at people from the window. But once they were mustered, and General Pershing at that time took that little company from that little place out there along the Mexican border, that was a company from another state taken to the New Mexico-Arizona border to repel an invasion. That's what that was all about. And but also the local militia, if the governor of the state, and he probably did, I don't know the history on that, he probably called them out. If he had of, he would have necessarily, if it was a recognized nation and a recognized foreign power who had signed on to the Geneva Convention, but recognize also Pancho Villa, I don't imagine he signed on to any Geneva Convention. So there are a lot of factors that figure into these questions that have to be answered. But as a general matter, if we went to war against another nation, and that nation's a signatory to the Geneva Convention, then the militia of the several states of any particular state would be under, each militiaman would be under that law called the Treaty of the Geneva Convention. That was your main question. You ask another question, and I don't remember what it was. Can you refresh my memory?
How did the police get by with using hollow point bullets when the Geneva Convention expressly forbids it on the battlefield, and shotguns as well?
Yeah, of course, the police forces, as a general matter, are not subject to the Geneva Convention because they aren't on a battlefield fighting against any nations that are signatories to that convention. What they do is domestic. Now, is there a law within your state or any given state, the question, that permits hollow points? And I don't know. It is kind of sad. I guess we the people permit this foolishness. Why don't we stand up and stop it, I guess, is the question. But no, as a matter of law, just as a matter of law, I don't see that policemen are subject to the Geneva Convention. There might be some other treaty they're subject to, but not that one.
Hey, Brent?
Yes.
There's a difference also in the goals of war, the Geneva Convention. Countries are fighting for land. A police action has nothing to do with that. Look, when a police officer needs to use deadly force, or you need to use deadly force, you want that person to stop. You're not trying to be nice. And all this business of shooting a gun out of his hand is all movies. If somebody's coming at you and you fear for your life, you want to stop him in the shortest order possible, and hence a hollow point. Now, a police action is different than declaring war. In war, you're supposed to be taking land. There's certain goals. And the goal of war is not to kill. It's supposed to overwhelm them so that they give up. So that they surrender.
Right. Okay.
And part of poking holes in people with hard-nosed ammo is because now it takes three guys to carry that one guy. You're not trying to kill him. You're trying to disable him. So, look, people sit around and talk about all this crazy stuff, but that's just the basis of that part. I just wanted to make that difference. A police action and a self-defense action is completely different than an act of war. And that's why we have the Geneva Convention, and that's why police use hollow points, because a police is not supposed to pull his gun unless he's planning on killing you. Just like if you're a concealed carry person, you're not supposed to pull your gun unless you intend on killing somebody.
Well, those are excellent points. I'm glad you brought them up.
So I just wanted to make those distinctions.
Okay, take our next caller.
Thank you, Gerard.
All right,
you're welcome.
It's Terry from New Jersey. Go right ahead.
Are any of you guys familiar with the Loigman case and the matter of Loigman in New Jersey? Let me just give you a little background on it. Several years ago, the grand jury was open to the public, but it was quickly closed by an opinion written by the Supreme Court. And I just started reading it, and this thing is just a bunch of twisted logic. I mean, you guys would have a field day with this. Let me just read you one thing that they say here, which is completely inimical of the Williams case. It says here in a Loigman case, the grand jury is a judicial investigative body serving a judicial function. It is an arm of the court, not a law enforcement agency or an alter ego of the prosecutor's office. The grand jury is a judicial investigative body serving a judicial function. It is an arm of the court, not a law enforcement agency or an alter ego of the prosecutor's office. But in fact, that's exactly what it is. And it's not an arm of the court, as the Williams case said. It's basically a fourth branch. I don't know if you've ever seen this case, but I'm thinking about challenging this but I wanted to I don't want to do anything right now, but because of what happened to me, you know, with false criminal charges filed against me in order to steal my father's estate. And this thing went all the way up to the New Jersey Supreme Court, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention. You might want to take a look at it, and you know,
what's the name of it again?
It's called In the Matter of Loigman. Here, let me just go up to the top of the case. In the Matter of the Grand Jury Appearance Request by Larry S. Loigman. I will forward this to the leadership, because down the road I want to challenge this, because it's just a completely contradiction of Williams.
How do you spell Loigman?
Loigman.
G as in golf, or D as in
golf? Yeah, G as in girl.
Okay.
And I was just wondering, have you... Go ahead.
No, Loigman, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, have you ever heard of a case where the grand jury is open to the public at any time?
No, I've never heard of such a case. By the way, is this a U.S. U.S. appeals
no,
case?
No, it's a state case. It's a state
New
case.
York?
New York? New Jersey.
Okay. Thanks. No, I've never heard of that. Matter of fact, the grand jury, the cases I've been involved in, I represented people before the federal grand jury, but of course I was not allowed to go in the grand jury, so I sat outside the grand jury and I'd tell my man, when they ask you a question, come out and ask me if you can answer it. And that's what we did. So that's as close as I got to getting in on those. But I have testified before the grand jury. I know what it's like to be inside, and most people, I suppose, probably never experienced that. It's important that when you go in front of the grand jury that you understand what the grand jury is, what you can do, what you can't do, who's in charge. You know, most people go into the grand jury to testify, and they get the impression that the prosecutor's in charge because he's running everything. But the prosecutor's not. He doesn't have all the authority. You know, you want to ask who's in charge here. Most grand jury members will say, well, the prosecutor is. You do what they say. I say, well, I'm not going to do what they say. I want to do what you say. You know, you have to have that kind of confidence if the grand jury is going to work, but seldom does it work. Most grand jurymen don't know what they're supposed to do. And as the Hyde Commission said a number of years ago, a prosecutor with a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich. And that's true. That is a federal grand jury, especially. That's utterly true. So it's a
that's why
dangerous
that's why
instrument.
We the people. That's why we the people need to take over this process and become the administration, and to teach the people coming in, to give them an orientation on exactly what it is that they need to be doing and what their vow is, and that they're in control. And and the grand jury should be open to the people. If someone wants to see the grand jury, they should be able to make an appointment to get in there to see the grand jury. Why not? This is the people's grand jury. This is the people coming to the people with a concern. And if they think that they have a case here that they want to bring before the grand jury, and they can bring enough evidence before it, and they can convince the grand jury to give them an indictment, well, so be it. If they can't, then so be that too. But that's the key to this whole thing, is really opening it up. Also, this idea with the prosecutor who does seem to control every story I've ever heard, anybody telling me anything about this process, anything you experience, it's always the same thing. The prosecutors, at least here in New York, constantly control the grand jury. And that's jury tampering right there to begin with. And the judge always controls the trial jury, and that's jury tampering. They both belong in jail. The other thing is since when does the prosecutor have any authority to make a deal with anyone over anything? If they're going to get an indictment and the grand jury indicts them, who is the prosecutor that they can let the person off the indictment and make some kind of a deal? They usually use that anyway for the sole purpose, really, to just take control of the people, to really intimidate and to get them to go to jail. You know, look, we'll give you 2 years, but if you go in, I'll tell you what, we're going to get you 20. You're done. And people take those deals because they don't want to go to jail for 20 years, so they get themselves a record and everything else. Look, the only one that has the power and the authority to make a deal is the grand jury itself, and that's it. They can make an arrangement between the two parties, the injured party, and of course the person who violated that injured party. They can make an arrangement that's agreeable to the two of them and not have to send it into the courts, and that should be done all the time. But if they can't, get a confession from the individual who's guilty and an agreement between the two that this is what needs to be done to rectify the situation, then it needs to go into the courts. But the whole system is up on its head. This has to be taken back to pure logic and back into the common law process.
Oh, I don't disagree. Yeah. Go ahead, George.
Do you remember when we had some videos up about a New York grand jury, how it operated? And it was a fellow named Boykin, and he had been a grand jury foreman 3 times. And there was a trial lawyer. She was a woman. She was like 30 years a trial lawyer, and then there was another woman, a black woman, who was running for judge, and she had a radio station, and she was interviewing them. And this fellow, I think it was Charles Boykin, was telling the process that the grand jury goes through with all these cases, because they plop all these cases in front of them, and they go through. And he says, okay, and then we look to see if there's any information packets. And the trial lawyer says, you're kidding me. And he goes, no. He says, that's the process. That's what you're supposed to do. She says, in the 30 years I've been a trial lawyer, she says, I have to push those information packets in. I have to stick my foot in the door. They don't take them. Now, an information packet is evidence that the attorney for the accused has that may have exculpatory evidence. And she had some young man that was committed of murder, and she had absolute proof that it couldn't be him. And she was saying how horrible it was to try to get to the grand jury to bring that evidence in. But in their rules, they're supposed to provide for that exculpatory evidence from either the person or the person's attorney. So they're obviously not doing it. They're falling down. But it is in the law, and it is acceptable. And Terry Tressel, too, in Florida, they brought him information about something that was going on in another county. And I think the law in Florida said that the grand jury foreman, if somebody brings him information of wrongdoing that goes into another county that he's not serving on that grand jury, that he can meet with the grand jury foreman of that county and bring that information forward to the jurisdiction where it belongs. So I think there's laws on the books that they're just ignoring. They're doing the Obama thing where they just don't care. Anyway, I just wanted to put that out.
Well, look, you know, we do have to be a little careful with this because, you know, the grand jury isn't there to try the case. The grand jury is to decide whether there's enough evidence for a case to be. But obviously, anybody who wants to see the grand jury, I can't think of one reason why the grand jury would reject seeing them, especially someone that wants to get in there and say something about a case that has been brought before them, and they would like to get what they know about this case and maybe evidence that look at this person couldn't possibly have done this because of A, B, and C. I mean, that's pure logic. You're wasting that. That means something's wrong here in the system, that someone is really, you know, setting this person up to come in. If there's actual evidence to show that a person is not guilty, and the prosecutor is bringing this evidence in, and he's not aware of that, then he's not doing his job to begin with, and most likely he is aware of that. But we do have to remember, we have to be careful. We do have to be careful to remember that the grand jury is not a trial jury. It's just to decide whether there's enough evidence.
But if you have exculpatory evidence, it should go no further than the grand jury. Why put the guy through a trial before you bring it out?
Well, the grand jury should deny nobody.
That's right. And
okay,
so,
if someone wants to bring something in, they should deny nobody.
I don't know if it was the U.S. versus Williams case, but it was another federal court case, big court on the grand jury, where the prosecutor held back the exculpatory evidence illegally. He had it in his hand and didn't make it available to them. And so I think that was the guy was suing, saying that the grand jury reached an improper, decision because the exculpatory evidence was withheld. And
well, the grand jury—that's that's pretty much what the Williams case was about, also to some degree. They wanted to overturn the grand jury indictment that shouldn't have went in because they should have taken evidence that I guess the other side wanted to bring to the grand jury, and the decision finally came up you can't tell the grand jury what to do and what not to do. The grand jury needs to decide on its own, and if they make a mistake, then they make a mistake. You know, then it could be fixed in the court, you know, when you get into the trial court to show that this person is not guilty. But the thing is they rejected that. Actually, the grand jury was denied, and then the United States Supreme Court overturned that and said, you can't overturn the grand jury. What are you talking about? You got to send it to court. Doesn't matter whether they were right or wrong. He didn't say that, but I think in a roundabout way he did say that. So they don't have to take this evidence. That's the fact.
No, I think
but it's wrong
did
if they don't
that.
Accept hearing and listening to everyone. Because anybody, look, if you have something to say and you want to bring it to the grand jury and you think it's important, the grand jury has to consider that fact. Now, the grand jury may take it and say, this isn't important at all, wasted our time, but not really. You know, this is what they're there for. They're there to listen and make some decisions here and hopefully some good ones.
I think the big issue is that when a prosecutor has exculpatory evidence that was given to him and he knows it,
that's a whole different story now.
That's a whole different story.
He never should have brought the prosecution to the case. And
that's right.
That's where the crime. That's a crime.
And that happens a lot because I don't
all
know why.
The time.
Because, yeah,
all
it happens
the time.
A lot.
All the time. They know that these people are orphaned. Look at what took place in Oregon. They all knew these people were not guilty of anything. So it took them so darn long to even do anything. But they knew there was nothing guilty of. They all should go to jail, every single one of them. And if we have our way, we'll indict them all, and we'll send them to a trial jury to make that decision. All right. Anyway, there's nobody in the queue. If anybody has a question or a comment, star six, and I think it's one to get in. Okay, we appreciate your time here, Brent, and we'll pass it over to Gerard.
Thank you.
And
thanks.
You can hang in there if you want to pipe in. You're welcomed.
Appreciate it.
Go right ahead, Gerard. You got. I'm not going to touch the board, so you hit the
okay.
next question.
I don't know if anybody has heard. There is a story on the internet that that some of the flag officers were watching the election for Trump. And that when the numbers stopped coming in, and I did watch this, I experienced when the numbers stopped moving, they said that was the point that they called, you know, because this is supposedly goes back to Bush from the CIA. They said, okay, throw the election. And I saw where, I forget what state it was, the number, they said, oh, it's 96% counted. And then it came back and they said, no, it's only 88 or 86. And the guy was all upset. He says, how do you miscount by 10%? And then after 5 or 6 minutes, it went up to 99. Well, they said that they realized that they were watching this thing and that there was a hack that came out of the CIA office from Virginia. And these flag officers called them up and said, you shut that thing off right now because we got planes in the air and we're going to bomb you. And so that's the story that's on Stuart Webb's page of how they stopped Hillary from completely stealing the election. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Anyway, we'll go to the next question. We have no name. We have 2005. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, give us your first name. Give us your first name and your state, please.
It's Jan in Kansas. And I just wondered, first a comment that it seems counterproductive for Chris Ann to want to make another department when a task force, for instance, well, my suggestion is that John and the NLA, Gerard, that what we could do is that we could ask for a task force on constitutional education or whatever. That way they wouldn't have a entire department that has to be supported into perpetuity, that if there's a task force on something, it can be studied, implemented, and then disbanded so that the taxpayers don't continue to pay for the same thing over and over.
I'll tell you what I think. I think the best thing that could be done to deal with this problem is to do what Jefferson said, educate the people, make them qualified. Let's do it. We're not qualified. We the people, all of us have gone through school. Maybe we all didn't go to college, or maybe we all didn't finish high school, but we've all gone through school. Just in grammar school alone, which I don't know why we would need any more than 8 years. I mean, what they teach them in 12 years can easily be taught in 8 years plus, because they mm-hmm. teach them nothing but garbage in school. They don't teach them how to think. They teach them what to think. But look, yeah. We should be our children. By the time they're 15, 16 years old, they should already understand, what's going on in this nation. They should understand how this government works. They should understand how the judicial process works. They should know our founding fathers and all the great quotes. They should know about common law. They should be educated enough to be able to know what is constitutional and what isn't. This isn't anything difficult. This is really, you know, look, at first, when you start to read the Constitution, at first wing, you know, it's a little complicated, you think, and a lot of stuff you don't understand what they're talking about to some degree. But as you work through it, you see how it's put together and, you know, how individuals are elected or chosen, and then, you know, what powers and authorities they have, what they can't do, and you put it all together, and it's really quite simple. This doesn't take someone to have some kind of, rocket scientist education or something. You know, anybody can understand this. So let us teach our children. It'll take a generation to do. But we, the people, we have to get off our lazy rear ends and go out and learn ourselves, because it seems a lot of people just don't want to learn. They'll take those civic courses. Go take the constitutional course. Go read our papers. Get an education. Understand what's going on. Understand what liberty really is. And know when they're pulling your chain and taking you down a road you shouldn't be. Understand that it really gets down, it boils down to two things. And always boils down to two things. Anything I ever looked at, it always gets to two things. It's jurisdiction and due process. It doesn't get any more difficult than that, because if you got your jurisdiction, if you're in the right jurisdiction and you're getting your due process, it's all about the story. What happened? That's what it's all about.
That's right. And that's brilliant to simplify it that much, John. I mean, that is absolutely, that means that you know what you're saying and that we can listen to you when you've got it boiled down that simply. I really respect you for that.
I kind of want to chime in. I agree with the gentle lady from Kansas. It's terribly misguided for somebody that claims to be committed to the Constitution to say that she wants the federal government to fund a Department of Education for the Constitution. That's bad policy, not a little bit, a lot. It shows a great lack of discernment. The only thing I can figure is somebody looking for a federal job. But anytime you turn education over to the government, I don't care whether it's state or federal, you're going to get the government's point of view as to the reason for every fact they teach. No institution of education has ever existed or ever will exist that doesn't exist for one reason, and that is to give meaning, their meaning, to the particular facts that are taught. What does this mean? Well, then they're going to give you the interpretation. That's why government schools, especially from the federal government, and the Constitution of the United States gives utterly no idea of any authority to the federal government to have anything to do with education, of course, not to fund it. Somebody said, well, they're going to do some things with the Department of Education, et cetera, et cetera. It needs to be eliminated immediately. Immediately. It is destroying us. We can't stand much. Education is not the answer. If education were the answer, our college campuses would be the most moral, ordered places on the planet, but they aren't. They're just the opposite. The problem is when you give government the power of education, then they miseducate. Education is not the answer unless you're getting the right education. And you're not going to get the right education ever for government, because government-funded and government-controlled education is always going to be politically driven by people who want to retain power for the sake of retaining power. Again, I'm appalled that this gal, and I've never seen her, never met her, I've heard about her, that she would promote this ludicrous, unconstitutional, evil idea. Jimmy Carter promised.
We do have to, you know, be careful in what we're saying here, from the standpoint that we don't. I'm not sure even that she made that statement herself directly. I know that she wanted to make contact with to try to work out some things concerning the Constitution with this new administration. But there was someone else that was writing some information, and I think they attributed it to her wanting to do something. They put words potentially in her mouth. Because when I first read that, I realized, first of all, wait a second here, the president doesn't have that authority to create that position to begin with. Okay?
Yeah.
So that, and she knows that. She's far more advanced in understanding of the Constitution than I am. I mean, she is really very excellent if you listen to her speak. I mean, she really, really unfolds the details of the Constitution and the authority. But so we really don't know what she wants to do. That may have been something stuck in her mouth that she didn't say per se, and someone might have taken that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, John. And also,
we do want to connect with her. We do want to get a relationship with her, because she is a powerful speaker. She's a powerful teacher, in my opinion, and others. And it's good to get a relationship with people.
So. My comments do not reflect what Brent was saying.
Hold on a second, Jan.
I want to make sure everybody knows my comments may or may not reflect the point of view of National Liberty Alliance, because I'm a guest here. So I'm glad you brought that up, John. But ma'am, would you go ahead? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, that's all right. I was just going to say what you were saying. Everybody, I mean, in my opinion, really what you were saying is exactly the point that I was trying to make, is that We do not need more acts of Congress. We do not need more departments. And whether Chris Ann said that or not, I mean, I would think that by this time, if she wasn't in agreement with it, she would have made a statement, I'm not in agreement with this. So back to what Brent was saying, really, I mean, I don't mean to sound bossy, but we need to listen to what he just said, because what we need to do is scale back government, not add to it. And the point that he made that I didn't even realize yet was that every time the government does something, it is for their advantage, not for ours. And yeah. I will get off the line here with that. Thanks for listening and your comments.
Let me make a point concerning those things. Look, at we have government by the consent of the people. At least we're supposed to have government by the consent of the people. That's our job and our duty, to educate ourselves so that we can give good consent or not to, what government does. We the people should know when they're making some kind of a law and they're putting something out there, to say, wait a second, the Constitution doesn't give them the authority to even talk about this stuff. Why? What are you guys doing over there? That we the people should be correcting them. We, you know, it is a nice idea for Congress that they should put in, you know, by what authority do they get to make their law. But why are we giving it to them to begin with? And they'll only make it up anyway. They'll twist the words and say, oh, we got the authority right here. And people, if they're not educated, they don't know, and they believe, and it's that simple. You know, so they want someone to interpret. We the people need to teach the people that they need to interpret it themselves. They need to understand the values of the words that are being spoken here and what the meaning is and how it applies. They have to do it. And we can't be lazy, because we have government by our consent. Why would we give it off to someone else? Why would we give it back to government to consent to themselves?
Right.
So this is what we have to do. And we have consent to government through the process of the grand jury, whether we're going to allow them to indict or to indict. We also have the ability to indict these people that are servants that refuse to stay in good behavior, which means to behave and work within the criteria of the Constitution. And we also have the right to be able to consent to our political process, which also has been stolen from us through the committeeman process, which goes right back to the committees of safety. And we're working on that to try to take that back also. And once we get those two back, control of the political process, control of the judicial process, now we the people do actually rule and our own nation ourselves. In other words, we have government by consent. We make the law, and we agree or disagree. And even if they make the law, and even if it's good law, a trial jury can come in and deny that law too. Okay? Mm-hmm. They can say, in this case, it doesn't work as far as we're concerned, and we're throwing it out. It means nothing. And that's the prerogative of the people.
Yeah. Well, while I got you guys, is the small claims court, is that common law jurisdiction?
Well, I would think that the small claims court really is, it actually works under really equity, I think, anyway, to begin with. But generally speaking, small claims court is really kind of arbitrational. And what you're doing is you're agreeing to go to an arbitrator, you know, instead of going to the court. And the arbitrator really, I have found these people that arbitrate, they try to make everybody happy. They're not really working to get justice here. I've been with an arbitrator in cases that I've done, and I've given up that process when I was working as a contractor to use arbitrators anymore, because they always seem to want to make everyone happy. And I'm not there to make everyone happy. I'm there to get what is due me. That's why I take people into the process, into the courts, and into the arbitrative system, or back into the courts now, is to get the money that people owe me. And if it's from the other side, if people have been burnt, they want to get their services corrected. Okay, so that's one of the problems I saw with arbitrators. So, but I don't know if that's really everywhere. But it is something that you agree to. It's an arbitration. Small claims court. Would you say it's anything more than arbitration, Brent?
No, I agree with you. It's not, by technically speaking, it's a common law court without a jury, and the evidence rules they try to follow. But it's pretty loose. And so, in fact, I agree with you. It's more of an arbitration, an equitable kind of thing. The judge has broad powers to do what he wants, and if you go in there, you may get a fair shake. Though that's what it's for, is to give justice to people without a jury. the judges try to follow some of the equity or the rules of evidence of the common law, but they may or they may not.
Yeah, I used arbitration in order to make the case go quick to begin with, because, you know, you get into courts, it goes forever to begin with, and you need your money. If you, from my standpoint, it's being a contract, I want to get paid. And also, you know, basically, you don't need a lawyer. You know, you can go in there and tell your story, and you figure the guy's going to, or the woman's going to make a decision on what's right and wrong. Where I found in my business, just to throw this in there anyway, if you can get an engineer or an architect to do an arbitration on a case, on a construction case, you do get justice there. I did have an arbitrator who was an engineer and did understand the process, did understand what was going on, understood what the rights and wrongs were there, and made a good decision. But generally speaking, it isn't part of the process. It's something, it's sort of administrative. You agree to something, arbitration.
Okay. And, John, are they going to charge you the $410 to file in Albany?
Well, we're going to go up there with the $410 in our pocket just in case, because we want to get the number one way or the other. I don't think that they're going to be able to. We've been to this court before and did get a case in without a number. We told them that, we don't pay for, the court case with the people. And then they wanted to fill our papers, and they said, we don't fill our papers with the people. And then we gave them, the paper. We have a file on demand, which explains the law and their duties. And she read through that, and then she filed the papers and gave us a number. So we're going to do that again. But if we have to pay the $410, we will pay it. But our first order of business will bring him or her, whoever the clerk is, into court to answer for that. It really was bribery. So
yeah. And is mailing the paper, sorry, I got a delay here.
Yeah, it was really extortion, but go ahead.
It's extortion, yeah. Is it more advantageous for us to file through FedEx or to mail the papers through FedEx rather than to use the United States Postal System?
Well, I want to make sure they get it and personally served. To get a service to personally serve it, that's too expensive. To have it done by FedEx is one way, but the other way to do it is also with a return slip certified with a return receipt, so we can go that way. I think that would cost us, probably about $5 or maybe about $5 between the two, between the certified and the return card, plus the mailing. So it's still going to cost us about $10. So I'm not sure.
Oh, I didn't know there was a legal advantage to sending something like that FedEx.
Well, FedEx, it goes straight to the person and they get a signature.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thanks, Brent.
Okay.
Rod?
We'll go to our next question here. And, I was going to say, as far as Chris Ann Hall, I don't know what she said. But, knowing her, I would doubt that she would want a whole thing of government started for that purpose. If she should do anything, she should educate the politicians that are in there already. And if they get her certificate and take her course, then the people should endorse them. And if they don't take it and they don't pass, then they should kick them out. And I would love for her to teach a course. And we, the people, tell these politicians that are in that they have to pass her course and get a good mark on it. Otherwise, they're out of there. But, and it wasn't that long ago that people used to recoil with the thought of a government school. And then they changed it to public school. But, in America, government school was something that, was over in Europe that had to do with Nazi Germany and all that stuff. That's where government schools started. But I don't want to beat that point to death. We got a lot of people on there, so I'm going to go ahead to the next caller now that I got my 2 cents in. Anyway, we have the next caller from the 970 area code.
Hello, Gerard. This is Ollie.
Hey, Ollie.
We have exhausted all resources. That prison, they interfered with Joe's legal mail. In fact, they stole some of his legal mail. He never got the rough draft of the transcript. I'm afraid to go on PACER. I went on PACER tonight. They have we've got to 12:22 to get an unredacted transcript, and I imagine I don't know what it's going to cost. I really don't. The senators got it in their mind they can't put any pressure on a federal prison. I went down and talked to a caseworker with Jared Polis, my U.S. rep, this afternoon. These people are not on Facebook. They don't have a clue what's going on. You go in there and talk to them about BLM stealing land and this and that, and they look at you like you're they're fully convinced that we are right-wing extremists. We are anti-government. And she told me, she says, he can't call a federal prison or put any demands on him. Our only chance is getting in mainstream media involved, and me and Lizzie, we called every tip report.
The only way this is going to be settled, and I've been telling you this for a while and trying to tell all those people out there, is they need to get us sworn affidavits. We are now ready to file these kind of things in the court. We're going after these people, but we can only go after the people that we have affidavits against. If we don't have a sworn affidavit against someone, we can't go after them. If we don't have the evidence against the judge, we can't go after the judge, you know? And this thing that's going on with Robinson right now, we need people to do affidavits on exactly what you're talking about right now and bring this in, because we can call them on the carpet. We're dealing with subversion against the United States of America. We're dealing with high treason. They're both working together, ultimately, you know, subversion, high treason. These are the cases we're dealing with. And we have a federal government out of control with an administration that encourages and actually makes these things happen this way. But we also have a new administration coming in with an individual who understands somewhat these problems out there. And it's going to be, look, it's very simple for him to put the word out. And this is what we're going to require in our paperwork. This is part of our, you know, a redress of grievances to the president, to the administration, and the new administration coming in. This is what we want him to do. We want him to order the BLM to stand down. We want him to demilitarize them, get rid of all of the, look at all of this equipment and things that these federal agents have, and even the stuff that even local police enforcement, you know, law enforcement has. Ultimately, they should be turned over to the armory and given back to the people. They should reopen the armories. I know here in New York they closed them all over the place. It's everything but armories anymore. But we need to reopen the armories. We need to stock them up. Well, let's take the equipment away from these people and put that in there. Well, the only people that should have any kind of weaponry would be those who are in law enforcement. And they certainly don't need a tank or some armored vehicle. They don't need that. That belongs in the armory. You don't come down after the people with tanks and armored vehicles. You don't come in with full military dress. With automatic weapons and sticking them in people's faces. You know, they're just trying to get around the military on American soil by militarizing all of the federal agencies. I mean, they've got the Oceanic Department or whatever they call that one. They've got their own SWAT team. The Department of Education, the Veterans Administration, they all have SWAT teams. What the hell do they want with SWAT teams? And they've already used that and abused that already. Department of Education did already with a warrant, which we're including in our case, concerning an individual who didn't even live in the house. You know, it was his estranged wife, and she didn't even live there. And they were looking for evidence, and they never went to the sheriff. There's one case where they took a tank and ran right into the guy's house with SWAT. I mean, who are these people, you know? So we got to take these weapons away from these people. We have to get the president to put the order down. They don't have this authority. If they have a situation and they think some kind of a warrant needs to be addressed and dealt with, they got the FBI. They got the marshals. Send it to them. The Department of Education shouldn't be dealing with it, nor the BLM. They should not be armed.
I don't think the FBI or the marshals need a tank. I think I've rethought this.
Right,
I think the sheriff should have it. I think the sheriff should have it, because then at least the people could get their hands on it. Look, they got we're supposed to have the same like and kind weapons as the military, because that's the whole idea behind the
well, the sheriff
Second
should still
Amendment
have access
and the militia.
To that. He should have the keys to the armory. It should belongs in the armory. And you can give the keys to the sheriff to the armory, too. I think we might agree with that.
It's supposed to be a deterrent against the government coming out after the people. That's what it ultimately is. And you know, and Obama thought twice about sending all this stuff to the sheriffs when they told that one out west to stand down or they were going to send their SWAT team. And he said, come on, I got my SWAT team. And he had military equipment. He had a helicopter and he had a tank. And he said, I'm ready. And Obama said, gee, maybe we made a mistake giving them this equipment. And you know what? They stood down when that happened. But anyway, I don't want to kill. Hey, Ollie, was Joe successful in firing his attorney? You see, because if he doesn't get that attorney fired, they don't worry about what they're doing, because as far as they're concerned, he has representation and his attorney's not hollering and they're free to do what they want. You see, if he was self-represented or he had an attorney that was actually working for him, they wouldn't feel so comfortable. They're feeling, and that congressman and those people that tell you that they can't go in a federal prison, that's baloney. Because if you tell a congressman or any other elected official or a judge or anybody that adjudicates law like that there's crimes being committed, they absolutely have, especially if it's in their district, they absolutely have authority. That federal government has less authority than that elected official does. He's elected by we the people. And if you go and you tell him about crimes being committed and he goes and knocks on the door of that jail, you better believe they better listen. You know, that aide that told you he can't tell the federal government what to do, they've been watching too much Elliot Ness and all these federal programs where they think the federal government is the do-all, be-all. The federal government's got to be the weakest police force in the area. And they're just slaves and they're brainwashed. That's baloney. And if that senator or congressman doesn't understand his powers, then maybe he needs Chris Ann Hall to explain them to him. Anyway,
okay. We have got one contact in the public defender's office. He is the chief investigator. He is a personal friend of Joe Robertson's. He has said that they did receive a letter from Joe. And we assume that it is the letter to Donahoe, you're fired, but nobody will tell us, okay, that it's all hush-hush, it's all control, and without representation, without a sheriff or a congressman with the balls to go talk to them, make demands on them, we can't do a dang thing. And Roger Roots,
you're not going to get anywhere without documentation. You must have documentation. You have to have the evidence in your hand. And even that is not going to be enough. You got to get a court that you can bring it into. And that's what we're trying to provide here, is a court that people can bring those things into.
That's another thing. Friday, Lindsay went down to her bank. Oh, we can't notarize that. We can't get involved in that. Jessica.
Well, that means that right there, that person's name should be taken, information, the place of business, the bank, or whatever it is, and you go to another notary, and that should be added into the process, that their reach has reached right out of the courts, right down to notaries. Okay? Someone needs to do an affidavit on this. Look at
you just threatened to turn
going
the notary
to be accomplished.
Into the Secretary
nothing
of State.
Is going to happen unless people get the documents necessary to make it happen. They fear nothing because you have no documents. You have no proof. It means nothing. They're not afraid. They don't care. When you start piling up the evidence, they're going to start to get a little nervous. And then you get into a court that'll hear it, they're really going to get nervous. And when you put their feet on the fire and you got to come before this court and answer to these things, now they're really going to get nervous. You see?
Well, she's doing everything. Let me finish.
Okay.
Jessica is a notary, Lavoie Finnegan's niece. She went over there Saturday or Sunday. When they were doing this, Jessica's mom cut her finger real bad. So Jessica went in and to cut whatever she was cutting, she cut her finger. So they quit doing the notary. Lindsay was going to go down to FedEx. They were closed. She's going to get them in tomorrow. But let me tell you what, when you're on a spiritual mission, you have all kinds of opposition. You have all kinds of, you got devils, the devil, we are fighting the devil. And sometimes it's hard to do the least little bit task. See, I know, we are so frustrated, we can't even get we don't have the affidavit yet. She's going to get that done tomorrow. But my question is this. How can we hold that warden in that prison liable?
Without documentation, bring it into a court of law, you can't. Someone has to accuse him. It has to be written on paper, sworn to, and he's got to rebut it. And they won't.
And also, this is also a good thing for a habeas corpus here. Any his legal papers, that's all falls under habeas corpus. The fact that they're holding his stuff back, that's all habeas corpus. And that goes to the jail.
But we can't do a habeas corpus, again, without a documentation. We need someone
that's
to do an affidavit as an expert.
And
it gets back to the same thing.
Yeah.
We've been trying to do a habeas corpus for him for quite some time, but we can't get anyone to do the papers. You know, I think, I don't know whether they're not listening out there or what. I mean, they're spending a lot of time, they're putting a lot of effort in it, but it's not going anywhere. I mean, look, at they did accomplish something. They did make a jerk out of the judge. They did accomplish something out there, so don't get me wrong on that. That was a big feat that these people made and got done, the work that they had gotten done there. But look, at if they're going to want to go after these people, someone has to do an affidavit. We got these a cop out there who killed Lavoie Finnegan, probably a couple of them, matter of fact. I don't know how many bullets got into him, but count the bullets, that they're different, coming from different weapons, and that's how many people need to be brought up in charges. But we can't go after them. We don't need to know their names. We can call them John Doe. We'll find out who they are. But we need to get everything together on this, and we can't do it without cooperation. If there's someone else out there doing what we're doing, then fine, go with them, get it done. But they have to understand jurisdiction, they have to understand due process, they have to understand the court they're in. They have to know how to be able to control that judge from taking it back. Not, the judges can't make no decisions in our court. We won't let them. They can't. Summary judgments are not constitutional in a court of law. But that's what they operate on. And if people don't understand that, then these judges are going to come out and make these summary judgments. Before you know it, they'll whittle them down to no witnesses. And we've seen those cases before. And that's it. You lose over and over and over again because the people don't know. And they've been sold a bill of BS with all of this fictional stuff that they have to do some kind of thing and say the right kind of words and click their heels and get out of there. You know, it's not going to happen. So it's very simple. Got to get documentation. You got to get it into a court of law and make sure the due process and the proper jurisdiction is taking place. And you got to watch it like a hawk. And once it moves to the right or to the left, you got to bring it back. And you got to go after the people who are trying to move you into jurisdictions unknown. It's always the same thing. It's always, it doesn't get any more difficult than that. Because that's how they rob us all the time. They rob us through jurisdictions, and they rob us through due process. People don't get it. Every habeas corpus we did is because people did not get due process. And even through the habeas corpus, they still refuse to give them due process. These people need to go to jail. That's a crime. They should spend as much time in jail as that other person has spent, plus some. As far as I'm concerned, if I spend 10 days in jail, and from somebody who did that illegally to me, I want to see them spend 100, 10 times. That's what I want. Tenfold. That's justice to me. But that's what we need. We need documentation as much as we can.
I have begged these people for affidavits for a year and a half. I've done everything I can to get affidavits.
Well, maybe they need... Try to get them to take our courses to understand what's going on here. They're going into places and they don't understand. They just don't understand. How are you going to win? They're children in these places ultimately because they have no clue what's going on.
Look at
you
once
know?
You once
they
you get the document once you get documentation and you get papers filed, That's when your phone calling and your rallies work, when there's actually a piece of paper, there's actually something sitting there to push through. Because if you just call, I mean, look, calling helps. You know, people standing outside with signs and
yeah,
marching,
well,
that's a political thing. But if there's a piece of paper sitting there that they're not acting on, that somebody could be brought up criminally on, it just makes the case so much better. It makes your efforts worth so much more. I don't think anybody should start marching or rallying until the paperwork is in, until you actually have something there to as your standard bearer. You know what I mean? Everybody can have a copy of it and march into the court. You know, you have to have something to lay for people to get their head around, and putting that piece of paper in is very a whole lot more powerful than you think it is. And when you hand something to a congressman or a senator or something, and he has a black and white document in his hand that lays it out, now it's not on him. In other words, you educate him. If you read our paperwork, it has everything in it and it has footnotes. All the paperwork that we write is educational. So any congressman or senator that picks up our paperwork and he reads it and takes his time, he's going to understand exactly what the issue is. He's going to understand what a court of record is, because it's all in there. It's all explained. And it just makes life a whole lot easier for these guys, because every time we go into the courts, we are educating them. That is how you educate them. This paperwork that we're putting in with all the footnotes and all the cites to the Constitution, that's an educational paperwork. And that's what we need to do. And I think that's what we should aim for. And let's start with the documentation as quickly as we can get it. And then we could do the civic action. Then we can do the Gandhi thing with people lining up and holding that habeas corpus in their hand that they refuse to answer. I just think it gives a whole lot more, stuff for people to sink their teeth into, if you know what I mean.
I've told these people in Oregon, Nevada, and Montana, the ones especially that's going to be involved, I said, hey, you need these affidavits. There's going to come a time when there's going to be a lot of litigation going down, and those affidavits will be invaluable. Yeah, I'll have them in Tuesday. And you never see them. It's so frustrating.
Look, we can do something for Robinson if we can get just one person, even if we have to embarrass someone into doing it. I don't know. Get them in public and embarrass them. We need one person that understands what took place concerning Joe Robinson, that can be his next friend and write that affidavit for him. That's all we need. We already wrote two papers for him, and they violated both of them. Well, we filed the appeal for him. And that was ignored. It was never filed. We also filed papers also on his behalf for showing the court that they had no authority to hold this man. They needed to let him loose. We showed that on paper. It's clear. And they still, what they do, they put him into, I understand they moved him to another state or something, or they trucked him around. But those are two papers we have. If we get the habeas corpus between those three papers, that's enough for us to pull that case into our court case. Because now, again, it gets back to violating we the people. It gets back to subversion. It gets back to ignoring the Constitution. It gets back to high treason, ultimately.
Lindsay has got the full documentation from day one to now. She's got it documented. All she needs to do is get it notarized. And we should have that. We should have it tomorrow, is all I can say.
All right, well, get it to us, and we'll act on it. I'd like to get the habeas corpus in and done so that 2-3 weeks from now we're in the courts. We'll pull this case in as one of the first few cases coming in. Try to get him out of jail before he dies. And we're going to let him know if they die, you know.
Here's the thing. He's totally isolated right now. And the hardest time for a veteran is going through the holidays. And he is all alone. He's totally isolated going through the holidays.
With his age, his illness, his background, the fact that he's a vet, that he has no criminal record, and that he was acting completely legal in everything he was doing, when you put it all together and you lay this up to show that they're coming out after this guy, that this is all vindictiveness. That's what it is.
Exactly.
And it's also extortion. They want that land. They don't want him to have it. And then We could show that, okay, that in itself, all right? We can show and make the point. This guy dies. That's murder as far as we're concerned. You see, you pull all that together and this guy dies, that's murder. That's conspiracy to commit murder, in my opinion.
Yes,
and I would bring that in before a grand jury. I bet you know, we'd get an indictment and I bet you we can get a conviction if the truth be told.
This would be the perfect case to make a habeas corpus work. It would be the perfect case.
We have 30 great cases, and we're going to get them all in. But
okay.
Yes, this could be one of the first ones we get in. This man desperately needs to get out of jail. So we would put him right up top, the top first couple to get him in if we can get the habeas corpus done.
Okay, well, I yield. Thanks. Well, thank you. But
thanks, Ollie. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Keep drilling away.
We can't quit. We can't quit.
Yeah.
I think somebody should go see Obama. Maybe he'll pardon him, do a good deed before he gets out of office. Anyway, imagine that. Our next questioner is New York David. You've been unmuted.
Yeah, hi. I was curious about this. I'm noticing in all of the local county offices and state offices that the American flag now has a yellow fringe around the flag. And I'm really very disturbed by that because that's not the real American flag anymore. And I was wondering if you could, talk about that a little.
Well, let me tell you a little story about that. And I understand that that's an admiralty flag. So it is a flag under a ship. And yes, they're taking us to jurisdictions unknown. Most people don't know. Most judges don't know. There was a guy that went into a local court and complained about it. And the judge got up, picked the flag up, threw it out in the hall and said, okay, you got any other problems? It didn't help his case at all. So that's where we're at with that, you know. Look, you can fight the flag, and eventually we'll send scissors to Congress and to the courts, and they can cut those fringes off when we come out of martial law or whatever they think it is that we're in here, you know. Or maybe we can just cut, like, a side a week off or something. I don't know. But, you know, they don't care, and they don't know. And I think the people that it makes a difference to are the people that really do know. But, you know, we're not dealing with those people. You're dealing with the useful idiot that's sitting there banging his gavel, making money on putting people in jail, and they do, whether you know it or not. And so,
right.
You know, eventually that flag will go away. But I'll tell you right now, it's not one of my priorities because it doesn't matter to me. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter because the guy that's sitting there, you know, doesn't even know it. Nobody knows it. They just think it's a nice decoration, you know?
Yeah, that's what I've been getting from people. They think it's decoration, and I'm like, no, there's only three colors in the flag, and this isn't one of them.
Yeah, and it's a point, but it's not a major point right now. It's like you got to pick your battles. So, I mean, look, the judge can get out and change it. I mean, if you want to make an issue at the only place that I could see that you could have an impact on that would be in your local court. If you could educate the judge and there's usually more than one judge in a town, the judges, and educate them on the admiralty flag and buy them a regular flag and say, please fly this flag in your courtroom because
this is the problem. Yeah, but that's not going to change his rulings.
No, I know it's not. I'm just saying,
look,
it's almost like having a lewd pigeon hanging there. You know what I'm saying? But you're right. It's not going to change his ruling. The guy who threw the flag out and says, got any other problems? He should have said, yeah, do you know the Constitution now? You know?
Yeah.
That's really my main problem. But
I'm sorry. The part that really disturbs me is that it's sort of slowly crept into all of our federal and state offices. And it's really, to me, it's like that's their little stick showing, hey, we're...
No, it's not like that. It's not like that. Let me tell you how it is. I'll give you my perspective on it. It didn't slowly creep in. You have people like George Soros that when it was time to change the flags, he made sure they got boxes of yellow fringes, and the ignorant people just hang them up because they don't know any better because they're not learning civics and they're not learning the Constitution.
Yeah.
So George Soros bought all those flags and put them in there, and if he's upsetting you, then he did his purpose. Most of them idiots don't, I hate to call them idiots, don't get me wrong, but you know what I mean. They're just not educated, and it's not affecting them one way or the other. And yes, those guys on top, those evil Illuminatis, those powers and principalities, it may make them feel good, you know. But it's not a big thing in my mind, because you don't want to give them anything to make them to where they can hang their hat on that you're a sovereign nut. And that's, all the cops ask, are you a sovereign citizen? And I say, well, I don't know what that is, but yeah, I'm sovereign. Aren't you the country sovereign? Is that a bad word? Do you know what it means? Do you know what the Constitution means? You know, and if you're telling me that you're not sovereign, then what country are you? And that's right, you're not sovereign because you work for a corporation. My buddy went through this whole thing on the road with a cop that would pull him over for not wiping the snow off his car. if you want to get in, see, I don't suggest that you educate them like that, but if you have the wherewithal to do it, and if you're nice and you got a, you know, you got a way about you, you can engage some of these police officers like that, you know, and they'll tell you.
I've been picking certain people because I go to a lot of different events and fair things. I've seen veterans post the colors with the yellow fringe, and I'm just like banging my head, like, how do these guys even not think to, what are they doing, you know? But it's like you're saying, I guess it's ignorance, and they're really not thinking about it. But
you want to know the truth, the veteran's probably the only one that should file the flight of flag with the fringe, because he's under admiralty and he's in the Navy and he's this, you know what I'm saying? They have fringe flags in the military, and maybe them guys are used to seeing them, and that's where it started. And now, of course, they're bringing that on the land. They're bringing it into our lives. And you're right. It's a kind of a point, and maybe it makes them feel good, but, you know, it's not really any voodoo that has any power, because like John says, you know, if we went and stole all our yellow fringe flags and replaced them with regular flags the next day, I don't think there'd be any more justice in this nation. You know what I mean?
John, are you there?
Yep.
John? I was just going to mention, according to the government websites, you look up several of them, the gold fringe had appeared very early on before the war between the states. But then later, President Eisenhower signed an order saying that the gold fringe was only authorized in military buildings and military installations. But I think we forget that before the war, between the northern and southern tiers of states, most Americans had never seen the American flag, because even up until then, flags, with fringe or no fringe, were nothing but military symbols. And so they only appeared on military bases, and there weren't, most people didn't get near one. And the only time the flag became really famous in America was after it was hauled down at Fort Sumter, because that was the first time the American flag had ever been really hauled down in any meaningful way, and it upset people. And so the flag became popular. But before that, everybody understood that flags were for military units. That's not something you flew over a post office, for crying out loud, or any other military installation. And then the yellow fringe, of course. So when we add the yellow fringe, admiralty is a form of the martial law, but Eisenhower said it's just a military flag. And I think that George, the one that made the point, people do it, they don't even know why they do it. I think that's true. It's a kind of a pretty thing to put that fringe on there. And I think people say, well, let's put this flag in the courtroom. And so they do it. But flags didn't used to be so much around courtrooms either. And most people never went in courtrooms anyway. And people were involved with government before that.
Yeah.
They didn't know anything about it. So flags are military emblems, period. And we've allowed them to creep out over our land and become part of our civilian life, and it's a kind of a bad thing. But that's what we've allowed to happen. Then we just want to throw that in, that I'd found that on U.S. government sites about Eisenhower and the fringe.
Boy, for the good old days of never being in a courtroom, I yearn for that.
I don't want to go either that much.
Okay. Thank you. You done, John?
I'm done, yeah.
Okay. All right, David, I'm going to go to the next caller now. He's probably...
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So hang on.
I only got one thing to say. If you want to win in a county court, make a federal case out of it.
Right. Pennsylvania Jim, you've been unmuted. Pennsylvania Jim. Or has he been unmuted?
Sure.
There you go. Pennsylvania
okay.
Jim.
I'm here.
Yep.
I want to try to give an example of our task of educating the people on grand juries.
Okay.
In the book, So Help Me God, by former Alabama Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore, he makes reference to a secret meeting that the county commissioners and judges had. And what they were saying was that the grand jury did not have jurisdiction to investigate the county budget. And I thought that was so funny when I read that. No, you know, with us knowing U.S. versus Williams.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make a point that we have a ways to go to educate.
They must have something to hide over there. If they don't want the boss to come in and look at the books, they must have something to hide over there.
Well, we had one of our members on here last week, that woman there, and she's having trouble in the courts, you know, the one they knocked her gas meter over. And so she started going to the town board meetings, and she wanted a line-by-line explanation of the police budget, and they said, that's not for the public to have. Imagine that. Heavens to Megatroid. What could the police be buying that they don't want the people that we're not allowed to know? I'm flabbergasted that they would even say such a thing. That's not for the public to know, the line-by-line police budget. You know, I mean, this is how far we've come. But
well, again, this gets back to ignorance, and it's our fault. We need to get educated. Anybody that's hearing that they need to get educated and not doing it, shame on you, because you're not doing your duty. You're not going to get your country back. You're not assisting us to get the country back. We need to understand what's going on. We need to know when they're breaking the law. There is absolutely nothing that the government does, okay, that we shouldn't have access to, okay? We want to look into anything. We have every right. We're the boss. We own this nation. We wrote the law. We should be able to walk into any government office under the authority of the grand jury, of course. You know, we don't want just anyone walking in. But the grand jury can appoint anyone to go and say, hey, we're sending our people over, and send people over to investigate if they're doing investigations already. But look, we have every right to walk in and open up the desk drawers, look around, poke around in the computer, ask questions. Just because we want to make sure everything's okay. Just to make sure. That's our unalienable right.
That adds the list up of all the misinformation. Look, we've had one place where they say the grand jury is a arm of the prosecutor, the judicial, right? And you got the other place where they say they're not allowed to look at the budget. And then you got Washington, then they got the, up here, they said, oh, no, they're not allowed to investigate any police shootings. I mean, what does the grand jury do anyway? Oh, my goodness. Anyway, I will move to the next one if you're done, Jim.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that with NOA. I laughed at first, but I think I'm going to be crying about it, though.
Yeah, okay.
One or the other.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. What do we got going here? We got 1910.
You lost one person, I think. I think Fred got kicked out.
Oh, I don't know.
But if he gets in, he can get in real quick. A few minutes. You only got a couple callers.
Yeah, we got
415. Name and state.
You've been unmuted there.
What's up? It's Jeremiah, California, Northern California.
Okay.
I know it's night. It's kind of noisy here. I'm in a train station. I'm pretty much always there. On the move. But I was just listening to the call, and I was making some notes, and I just want to say I hope all is well for everyone. Here we go with my notes here. Regarding the enforcement issue, okay, on the grand jury, I don't know if others will concur with me about this, but I believe that in order to get enforcement of a grand jury, this train is going to be gone in a second, but in order to get an enforcement of a grand jury, like, information or report, you have to have some sort of attorney general also alongside you to be able to process the claim into the court, okay? So to play a particular role, if you will, which is why I believe the private attorney general is the perfect position to actually do that. Would you guys speak to that? That's the role of possible attorney general in helping the grand juries that come up with information, enforcing. So people basically in their communities, part of the committees of safety, could be people who are actively participating as private attorney generals to help the class of person known as the people. Because, you know, the people are not the actual state government themselves. We all know that. But, yeah, certainly when it comes to enforcement, I think you all agree that we need that private attorney general to come in and help out on the local level there. And I think we're going to find that it's going to be quite necessary. Do you want to address that real quick?
Maybe not. But, you know, first, my question is, because I don't understand anything about the private attorney general. I've always tried to get some information on that, but I just have no clue. Maybe someone can educate me on this sometime. It must be a book or something out there on it. But look, at what we're going to be doing here is something a little different. Mm-hmm. We don't need people to be arrested once we make an indictment. As long as we can get a courtroom and get a trial jury up there and give them a trial, that's all we need to do. Because at the end of the trial, if there's a conviction, then the individual needs to be taken and brought in. If it requires a jail time or if it requires some other kind of restitution, enforcement has to get behind it at that point in time. And that's why we're doing this case up here. We're doing
Let me interrupt that because I have a short amount of time.
By all logic, it can be done.
I only have a short amount of time to speak, but basically what it comes down to is that this prospective judge, his name was Victor Wong, right? He's running for judge. He was a prosecutor for 20 years here in San Francisco. And he said that there's nothing wrong with the civil grand jury's reports or information. The problem that they were having that was noticeable was they couldn't get them enforced, okay? And I took that to mean that even in the county, at the county level, enforcement is an issue. So
that's because there's a thing going on between the prosecutor and the judge. That's why they didn't need enforcement. You see, because if the grand jury says A, B, and C, and the judge shakes his head to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor winks his eye to the judge, they're not going to get enforcement because they're protecting each other and they're protecting someone else. It's called corruption. We, the people, have the authority. We have to enforce it. Look, that's why the administration, we need an educated administration. Anybody who thinks they're going to become an administrator and wait to get educated, you're way behind, way behind the eight ball here on this thing. You got to get educated now because we need people who are able to write the necessary papers for the grand jury. The grand jury, once you, give them an orientation, you give them the vow and they mm-hmm. understand the principles, you get a day with them and they understand the principles. Now they know what to do. Now someone has to sit there and write their will up in a way that works with the court system.
Let's just put this
and
out there. This is
that's where someone that needs to be educated, that's where the administrators come in. And we need people who want to become educated in those areas.
Absolutely. And I hope you guys think that I could hopefully at least help out in some area, regarding administrative process. But
take the courses and sign up. Anybody wants to become an administrator.
I hear that. Let me wrap this up. You guys, states and municipalities are the real sovereign citizens. I've been saying this for a really long time. It's plain to see that with the hatred that came from the decision right by Trump to refuse federal funding for sanctuary cities, right? That came from San Francisco and other sanctuary cities. The refusal of these municipalities to literally follow these the federal law, right? When they're receiving the federal funding, And you know what they've done is literally create this city ID card, okay? And in it, they had a headline in the newspaper, and it was talking about them not releasing any information to the federal government regarding the people that they were having, that they had in their sanctuary, okay? And it was, it, to me, what it showed was outright just disrespect for the law. And it was blatant that at that point that the cities and the guise of the state, because they are the arm of the state, they're really the sovereign citizens. And the labeling of individuals by the FBI as the sovereign citizens is part of the actual, is part of the mind game, the manipulation to actually get to distract people from the real truth, you know, that we have all on this call most likely discovered already. But that's it for me. Jeremiah from Northern California.
What you mean.
Thank you,
I don't
Jeremiah.
Understand what you mean by that, though. What do you mean? What he's
saying is they're the real terrorists, and I've been saying that. If you read the definition of terrorism, they fit it. They're terrorizing us. They're accusing us of being sovereign citizens. Well, that's what they are. Because he said, look, they said we're going to keep these people in sanctuary. We're not even going to tell you who they are. They could be murderers. They could be terrorists. But we're going to hide their names, and we're going to protect them. And we don't care what you're saying, even though we're accepting your funds. So they were arrogant, and I agree with him. I want to bring another point out, a couple of real quick things. Look, a private attorney general is generally, they're appointed through the judiciary to do a job that needs to be done. Usually there's corruption, and so they don't want to give it to a prosecutor. And so if a citizen brings something, a case in that they've been working on, the judge can appoint that particular citizen, a private attorney general, to pursue the case, and he actually can draw a salary for doing that if it's for the good of the general welfare of the people. You're not going to get too many private attorney generals out there because the government doesn't generally want to stick their finger into their eyeball and pluck it out, and if you had too many private attorney generals doing a good job, that's what would happen. But I lost my train of thought the private attorney general. Oh, the attorney general. Look at the attorney general. Every time we get involved with the attorney general, he's always against the people. If you look at his website, though, they call him the people's attorney. He's supposed to be protecting us, but instead he's defending the politicians. He's defending the government. He's never protecting the people. They do the exact opposite of what they're supposed to do. And so, you know, when they call this system the criminal justice system, they're not kidding. It is a criminal justice system. So anyway, yes, Crystal, you have been unmuted. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes.
I'll be quiet.
We had a horrible incident here in our town today, and I witnessed the whole thing from the beginning to the end. The person had her. The property, the title, the volume, page, deed, it's in their name. They threw the family out the house. We contacted the attorney general, the Congress, all of them. So I heard you say that we got to get the sworn affidavits, which we also even had the police. The so-called marshal changed the paperwork from Saturday for the eviction, which is the thing is still in bankruptcy, which they overdo that and changed it, whited it out. We got all the proof on that. And so we're going to file the affidavits. Now the family is in a hotel right now. I mean, it was the most devastating. It was devastating.
So who pulled the family out? The marshals?
Yeah. And the marshals is the one that changed.
Yeah, they're state marshals. They don't have. She's in Connecticut. They don't have sheriffs. They created a position called marshals, and they're appointed, aren't they? Who appoints them?
And we also have the TV media. But see, they flipped it around. And I told the party, I said, "This is what you do. We call the media in. Make sure you have it." Have somebody to record it while it was going on. So this way, you know, so put it on Facebook, put it out there. And she's, you know, that's where she basically really messed up because she should have had that. which we still, you know, got the information and stuff, but, you know.
Was this a mortgage company thing, or was this a tax?
Yeah, but you're right, because the property was in her name. You know what they've been doing with these mortgages.
Yeah, I know how they're doing it, but it was a mortgage thing. It wasn't a tax foreclosure. It was a mortgage foreclosure.
All right. Okay. But it was. Yeah. They were all debt collectors. We all filed.
And they did it outside of due process. They did it with non-judicial foreclosure.
Not only was it due process. On Saturday, they came to her house and changed it for her to be put out of her house the 24th of November. Then they turned around and changed it, whited it out, and bought her another one saying it was going to be at 9 o'clock on Monday. And it was the marshal that did it. Courts are closed on Monday. I'm sorry?
And she's in bankruptcy court at the same time?
Right, and they wasn't even supposed to do anything.
Right, if she's in bankruptcy.
Wow, she should go to the bankruptcy judge then. Yeah,
well,
go down to the bankruptcy judge.
Well, they did, and they all started backing off because they, you know, we even contacted the mayor of the town. We contacted the police department, everybody. We contacted the Congress. We contacted them all.
Yeah, they're doing a tighten up, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that is, well, they all stick up for each other, you know, and.
But the wink and the nod,
you know?
But the ironic thing of it is the volume page deed is in her name. And they
the
never
what?
Checked that out. The volume, the page, deed, and title is in her name. Like myself.
So they don't have any.
The idiots never checked it out.
No authority to take it because they would have had to convert the deed, John. In other words,
exactly.
Everything's still in her name.
Exactly, just like mine. It's in my name.
Well, I don't, you know, it's tough. What are you going to do in that situation? You know what I mean? Unless you're going to sit in there and you're willing to die with a gun, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but see, unfortunately, the crazy marshal, he didn't do his homework, and now everybody's, you know what I'm saying?
Even the sheriffs don't even do their homework.
That marshal should have charges brought up. He should be sued in a court of law for not upholding the law. And a marshal, he's an appointed sheriff. Why don't you have like?
Well, look, the whole thing gets back again to one thing.
We just found out that she didn't get a due process, right? Right. And
there
you know
go.
What we found out?
It's a federal issue now.
We found out because when I contacted the Attorney General's office last week. And I said, well, the sheriff. They said, well, we don't have no more sheriffs. I said, why don't we have sheriffs? Oh, well, the legislator did away with the sheriffs. The legislator did away with the sheriffs? I said, what year? Oh, about 8, 9, 10 years ago. I said, oh, really? But there's still a few sheriffs around. As a matter of fact, one of them got arrested. But I think
they did it by referendum, is what they did out there by.
Mm-hmm.
And they put it on the ballot. Right, and there was no power or authority. You can't get rid of common law through democracy. I mean, come on. So look, that is one of the things we got our eyes on. It's Connecticut and their sheriff problem. We got the same problem in 7 of our counties here in New York, and that's one of the things we want to bring up into the court case here, to bring the sheriffs back, and not only in these two states, but in other states also.
Right. But we'll get those. Over those
right.
Affidavits is over. Okay.
Okay. We're past our time, so we
okay.
got one of the caller left. Fred, we'll just give you a minute or so because you've been on already. But go ahead, Fred. You got a final comment or a question?
Yes, I had a question, but John, it's pretty late. The question
okay.
was, and I know I'm going to make you angry here because we're going into the fiction.
I don't go into the fiction.
I know, sir. We the people only authorized Article 3 courts.
Right.
And they claim, according to, I can't find the Supreme Court judge and the decision, but I will find it. He made a comment that there is no criminal court. There is only
right.
commercial violations with criminal penalties and fines.
Well, there's only look at the in common law. There's just one court. There's not a civil side or a criminal side. It's just a court, and they've made the you know matter of fact, the Supreme Court has made the mention. If it calls itself a criminal court, then it's not a court of record. It's that simple. But anyway, why don't we bring this up next week? It's a good conversation to have, okay?
I would like Mr. Winters to maybe address this if he's still around. Maybe next
Brent,
time.
Brent, if you could do it in 2 minutes or less, or we could do it next week.
No.
Brent,
are you still listening? Next week, commercial violations with criminal penalties and fines. That's what they're doing to us.
Yeah, but it's all unconstitutional. It's all unlawful. It's conspiracy. It's subversion against the Constitution. It's subversion against we the people. It's high treason. When we're brought into
commercial violations with criminal penalties. Boy, there's a Darwinian statement. So in other words,
it sounds like the IRS.
We have debtors' prisons then, right?
It's a
commercial violation, and we're going to give you a criminal charge. You didn't pay that, so we're going to shoot you at dawn. That's pretty good.
But the IRS has a debtor's prison. Go ahead, Brent.
Is he quoting a court case, Fred? Are you there?
Yes, sir. It's a Supreme Court decision. I have to look up the case and get my ammunition together, and I will email it
to
you.
Will you email it to me, or email it to commonlawyer.com?
Yes, sir, I sure will.
Just go to that website. If you find something, then I'm going to look at it, see what you're talking about.
I've been there, and I'm still saving to buy your book.
You're doing what? Saying what?
Saving to buy
your book. I want you to have it. Well, I look forward to your email.
No, I will. The worker is worth his work. His worth.
Yeah, we're talking about it. Thanks.
We've come to the end. We're past our time. We're 7 minutes over time. Lord bless everyone. We'll see you next Monday, Lord willing, and let's get active. Let's do things. And please consider giving extra money this month to help pay for this court case, and everyone should be given $5 a month or more. All right, have a good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming.
as they fall from your own.